order. Many people have told me of special circumstances, and I see people in the audience and make sure that Ms. Sales knows that you're here, and we will get to you in as promptly as possible. But everybody can't be first. And I did early on say that the people from farthest away would have their chance because they have to go back home. But even with that being said, I just want to take a minute to remember a friend. Jim Pearson from Minneapolis, since our last meeting, has died. And Jim Pearson was a friend to all of us at the commission for years and years. And before that, he was a friend in the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers that I, as a teacher, worked with for years and years. And I don't remember, although I love you all and your dedication to the profession and to retirement issues are very, very important. I can't think of anyone that lived retirement as a profession as much as Jim Pearson. And I think it's good that we remember him at this meeting and from day to day, because indeed he is missed. Representative Junkie. House File 3021, Senate File XXXX.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I won't belabor it. I brought my hospital administrator, Lori Massa, and he explained the bill to you and moved along as rapidly as possible, which I'm sure you'll appreciate.
Mr. Massa, briefly tell us about your situation. We've had a few of these situations in the past, so we know what to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Rice Memorial Hospital in Willmar. Rice is a 90-bed regional acute care hospital offering a wide variety of primary and secondary inpatient and outpatient services to people in a 14-county service area. We also operate a 78-bed skilled nursing facility, an outpatient rehab center, and a home medical equipment and respiratory care business. We have approximately 900 employees, and we're owned by the City of Willmar. We recently entered into a joint venture arrangement with our largest physician group, Affiliated Community Medical Centers, to consolidate cancer and imaging services in the community. Affiliated is an 11-clinic network based in Willmar with approximately 110 physicians. Affiliated currently offers medical oncology, including chemotherapy, at the clinic. Rice offers radiation oncology at the hospital. Both organizations currently have full-service imaging departments, including CT scanning, MRI, and nuclear medicine services. The joint venture is intended to better coordinate patient care and eliminate unnecessary duplication of expensive equipment and services. All cancer services will be consolidated at the hospital campus in a single location. Imaging will continue to be offered at both sites, but some services will be consolidated at one site or the other. While the joint venture in the service lines of cancer care and imaging is new, we have an existing joint venture with the clinic involving an ambulatory surgery center that has been in place since 1986. The joint venture entity is a limited liability partnership owned 50-50 by the clinic and the hospital. It's a private for-profit entity. Both parties have agreed to transfer our employees performing services related to cancer treatment and imaging to the joint venture no later than July 1, 2009. There are approximately 42 employees at Rice affected by this change. We are seeking the legislation before you this evening to protect and enhance the benefits earned by our employees under PERA. Chapter 353F of Minnesota statutes was created a number of years ago for this explicit purpose when public health care entities choose to privatize. We are seeking to add the affected Rice employees to this statute. We've worked closely with the staff at PERA in this process. An actuarial study has been completed which indicates that the privatization of these employees under the terms created by Minnesota Statute 353F will not adversely affect PERA. The recommendation to support House File 3021 and Senate File 2855 will greatly benefit these dedicated employees, many of whom have been at Rice for over 20 years, and will facilitate the orderly transition to the joint venture. I would greatly appreciate your support for these bills. Thank you for allowing me to testify this evening, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have. I would also point out that your staff has prepared an excellent summary that covers all of the details.
Yes, they have, and they do. Is there someone from PRA that has any additions? No additions. So everything's fine. Okay. Mr. Burke, anything else?
I would simply say that the approach taken in the bill is consistent with the policy that you've been following recently. The actuarial work is included in the attachments if you wish to review that. And it does show that there would be a gain would accrue to PERA if this privatization under the terms of the law were to be approved. But if you were to look at the liability, if these individuals were treated simply as terminated employees, you'll notice that gain is greater. So whenever the commission does use this model, the commission has required that there be some gain to PERA, or at least not a loss to PERA, but that treatment does create some foregone gain to PERA because they give away part of the gain in the form of these enhanced benefits. With those comments, I turn it back to the chair.
Okay. Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson moves that House File 3021 be included in the be passed and included in the omnibus pension bill. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The motion is
and
adopted.
Members.
Let's see if we can do the Worthington one a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're all by yourself?
Well, we'll make this as fast as we can, Madam Chair.
Holy cow, I had you second because I thought you had somebody from far away. Go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, I do have somebody.
Oh.
We have some questions, but otherwise, myself and Senator Vickerman.
Well, come and sit next to him. So someone doesn't walk in and say, you let Hamilton go ahead of me.
I wouldn't want him to be alone.
That's right. So Senator Vickerman couldn't be here. He was called back home for a funeral. But this is Worthington Regional Hospital was sold to Sanford. And the sale is going to be final July 1st. And so, of course, we need to make some accommodations to address that. I've spoke with the individuals with PERA, and there's no issues there or no additions as well. So,
okay. Mr. Burke?
This is mine, actually.
Oh.
Members, for the Worthington Hospital, the only thing I would point you to is page 3 of the memo where we do summarize the actuarial work. The traditional policy has been if there is a net gain to PERA after we include the privatized employees in the special program, if there's still a net gain, then it meets policy. And as you note, there's still a net gain. The bottom line, there would be a almost $6 million gain to PERA if the hospital just simply privatized. There will still be about a $4 million gain with the proposed legislation.
So it's a good thing, Mr.
Hamilton.
Representative Hamilton.
Make it easy, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
I move the bill.
Representative Nelson moves the adoption of House File 2589 and Senate File 2501 to be included in the omnibus pension bill. Is there any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. see now. Senator Sinjum, do you have someone with you? Okay, then you're up next. House File 1495, Senate File 1644.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. I appreciate the hearing opportunity. Madam Chairman and members, this case is a single situation, single person, single entity in terms of an event. It involves a deceased individual, Douglas Clausen, who is a police chief in Hayfield, Minnesota. And it goes about the question of whether or not this individual was injured in the line of duty to the extent that it resulted in his ultimate demise. And the bill basically suggests that we ask through this commission that the Commissioner of Health review those autopsy results, and if there's a determination at least that this occurred in the line of duty, that the surviving spouse, in this case Ms. Clausen, be certainly awarded the due benefits. So I think that's the essence of it. It has been before this commission before, and we're back. I think it's been a couple of years since we were here last.
Is there anything changed since? Is there any new information for us since the last time?
I would ask Ms. Clausen.
Well, due to all the information that's documented and that I would be able to provide that would substantiate the claim, I think that it would be fair to have someone review that through the Commissioner of Health,
but
in their expertise. It's not something that probably board members, because of the complication of the case due to the length of time, but everything is well established and documented that I feel that it would, you know, be only fair that that could be reconsidered.
Senator Sinjum, we have a new Commissioner of Health now.
Right.
And the
yes,
new Department right. of Health, so a new administration. Have you approached them yet to review?
Madam Chair and members, no, I haven't. I think that would, I'm not sure that would be in my purview or ability to do. I think it would probably mean a release of some sort, perhaps from the deceased okay. wife. I'm not sure, honestly, but no, I've not done that.
Okay. Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of PERA. If this bill were to proceed, the medical information should be given to PERA and forwarded to the Department of Health to have the physicians review it. I have to say that we would be concerned about opening this door. Just before I came up here tonight, I did review the record from the initial application and what was presented to our Board of Trustees. And all of the medical information at that time indicated that it was ALS. So we had that information before us. And I know that this is a very sensitive issue for Mrs. Clausen. However, we went as far as we sent Mr. Clausen to an independent medical evaluator because there was concern that there wasn't sufficient medical to help substantiate, you know, the claim that they were saying it was injury related. And all the doctor's information that the board reviewed back in 1978 said that there was no clear conclusive evidence that the injury caused what he was suffering from. They had diagnosed it as ALS. And that's why the board made the decision that they made back in 1978. So there would be two issues here. What the bill would do is provide Mrs. Clausen with a survivor benefit based on the former member's account. And if that were to start on July 1st of 08, that would be about $148,545 cost to the police and fire fund. A refund was taken, and the present value of that refund to repay it, to repay that refund to us, to at least restore that amount of credit in that account, would be $12,707. That is one of the amendments that staff has in here. But with all due respect to the sensitivity of this issue, I do have to say that we would oppose allowing this to move forward.
All right. Any other information? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I just attended a funeral today for Kathy Swanson, who died from ALS. And because she's a relative of mine through marriage, I learned something about that disease. And one thing I learned was that the average survivor length of surviving for someone diagnosed with ALS is about 5 years. And so I guess I'm wondering, since Mrs. Clausen, since your husband lived for so long, was there at any point at a later time, did anyone ever diagnose him as having something other than ALS?
Yes.
Is there evidence of that, Madam Chair? I guess I'm wondering, or have you had an opportunity to provide that evidence?
Ms. Clausen.
Once that they had the availability of a CAT scan that they could look at the case, because he hadn't died and he wasn't losing his speech capabilities and all of the things associated with the Lou Gehrig's disease. Then when the CAT scan was done, they could see where the spinal cord had been ruptured inside and there had been bleeding in there. And then also the diaphragm had been injured and paralyzed, which caused multiple breathing problems as it progressed through the years before. And I was told by a Mayo physician that I asked how possibly with a diaphragm anyone could breathe, because that was the mechanism that provided that. And he said in those cases the stomach will take over. Nature has it that that's what happens. And if you would happen to see him where he was sitting in a chair, you could see that the chest did not move, but that the stomach did move. And I was with him the night that he got hurt. We didn't live in Hayfield at that time. We were moving there. And I was sitting in the squad car when the gal blew the stop sign and raced through town. I jumped out. He took off. And he didn't come back and didn't come back. And then later, when he did, he was in such pain that it was excruciating. And from that day on, it was nothing but deterioration because of all the damage it had done inside. But he was a very positive person and did everything in his power to live life the best he could with what he had been dealt. And he'd often said, the officer in the street who was shot and killed, they are so fortunate because their pain is gone. And the thing is, when you live through that type of thing on a day-to-day basis, it is something else.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, we see and hear a lot of difficult cases before this commission, but I think that the issue brought before us tonight was heard by this commission previously, and it has been we've been advised that there is in fact no new information. And Madam Chair, I would respectfully ask that Senate File 1644 be laid on the table.
Senator Lynch moves to lay the Senate file on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Turner syndrome.
Madam Chair, in the essence of time, I will. Ms. Means is here now. I will start, and this is a situation, Madam Chair and members. Ms. Means, as I understand it, was part of a general employee retirement plan of public employees. In other words, a para general member with past para covered service as a school district employee. Also worked with Olmsted County and has since terminated that. Is currently a Rochester City Council member. In fact, she took my seat on the Rochester City Council. And my understanding of this is that the approval of this would allow her to commence a para general annuity while still serving as a council member. In reading through the description or the provided summary, I did note that on one other occasion in a similar situation, this was granted.
And your guest?
Madam Chair and members, my guest is I'll call her the Honorable Sandra Means, City Council Member from Rochester.
Councillor Means.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the Commission, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to come before you today. I did work for 10 years for the Rochester Public Schools as a para member. In December 31st, 2003, I retired from the school district. In the meantime, on May 5th, I was elected to the City Council to fill a vacancy and was reelected to a four-year term in 2004. During the 2003 time frame, I was anticipating my retirement and went to the para office and spoke with the para representative to apply for benefits. Well, this was denied because I was already contributing to para as an elected official. And the requirement was explained to me that I had to terminate all public service and that, of course, would be to resign from the City Council. And I did not want to do that. I felt that I owed the constituents the responsibility to serve and represent them about 20,000 people per ward. And I think I've done a good job and would like to continue in that capacity. So, as it referenced in your Appendix C, there is precedent being set in Bemidji. And this was initially given to me by the para representative that this was a possibility. If I could go to my representative to see if they would speak on my behalf to get this successful special legislation passed and allowed to discontinue para. So what I'm asking is since the precedent was already set, would you favorably consider allowing me to terminate my membership in para so that I can continue to serve the citizens of Rochester and Ward 6 specifically?
Ms. Vanek, come down and tell us.
Am I going to be a bad egg? For the record, Mary Vanek, PDRA Director. As Ms. Means did indicate, this has been done in the past a couple of times. And what it would mean to her is that we would reduce from her account, to take out of her defined benefit account the salary on which she has contributed as an elected official. And that means her benefit would be reduced about $44 a month.
and then the amount of money that could either be transferred to the defined contribution plan if she chose to participate in that going forward or to take a lump sum refund would be about $5,500 for her contributions and another $6,006 for employer contributions. So under the bill, that would be that includes interest, would be transferred to the defined contribution plan if this bill is approved. So the only thing I can say, Madam Chair, is that you have done this before for individuals, and there's no negative impact to the fund by doing this.
But, Councillor Means, I don't quite get why you want to do this.
Well, I thought that after I retired, I would draw para. Probably was partly due to my naivety. And that's why I went and asked for the disbursement of the funds and was then informed that, in fact, I could not, because I was an elected official, contributing as an elected official to PARA. So I thought that after I retired from the school district, I was entitled to receive whatever benefit there would be.
Okay.
And so when I was informed that I had to terminate from the city council, I elected not to do that.
Okay. Ms. Thanek.
Madam Chair, our law allows that if an elected official is in our defined contribution plan and is also participating in our defined benefit plan through other service, they can, in fact, retire from that other service and collect their pension without quitting their elected service position. There is no 30-day break requirement when they are two distinct participations. But in her case, she elected to participate in the defined benefit plan on her earnings as an elected official. And so she would have to terminate that position and be out for a full 30 days in order to get a benefit based on all of the service on which she's made contributions to the defined benefit plan. So she is asking to ignore that she elected into the defined benefit plan on her city council earnings, back them out of the calculation of her defined benefit, and then either refund what was contributed on those earnings or move it to the defined contribution plan.
Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I'm aware of other situations, and up in my area, we've had some suburban city council members who had similar situations, and they found very creative ways to retire from their regular job, at the same time quit the city council, and then get reappointed to the very same position that they quit 30 days later. And then I remember one such situation, I believe it was in Brooklyn Park, where somebody actually got elected to a new term, then quit the city council, and then in January started her brand new term, because they recognized the problem between in the situation, and left the constituents scratching their heads, saying, "Well, wait a minute, you just quit, and now you're back. How does that happen?" And it looked bad. Now I think Ms. Means tried to actually make it look the right way, and it didn't work to her benefit to do it. So I think there's a problem the way that these two are structured, and there's got to be a better way to make them more seamless. I don't think anybody gets on these city council positions solely so that they can enhance their retirement benefits. They do it for public service. But they shouldn't be penalized or have to play these games, if you will, of getting off and getting back on so they don't mess up their pension. So either way, it looks bad, but I think we're going to have to just deal with this is a situation as it happens.
I know of a situation too, Senator, up in Bill Hilty's district. Mm-hmm. And of course, if they quit, they never know for sure that they're going to be reappointed.
Yeah, that's the chance you take. Yeah.
Ms. Vanek, do we have legislation in the making to address this situation so we don't have individual bills in the future?
Madam Chair, I can tell you this. When we changed the law in 2002 to exclude elected governing positions in the defined benefit plan, we referred to newly elected. And the way the statute was written, there was an interpretation made with consultation with our legal advisor that if somebody was already in the defined benefit plan and was elected after the 2002 date and didn't have a 30-day break in service, that they literally should be allowed to opt in to the defined benefit plan on that service. We corrected that last year so that there is no room for interpretation. Anybody elected to a local governing body elected position from this point forward has only the defined contribution plan as an option. So even if they're working in other public service under PERA, they will never be able to get into the defined benefit plan. Now, that being said, I heard from some county commissioners last Friday who would like to see that overturned. But current law says if you're an elected body, governing local government official, you cannot contribute in any way, shape, or form. There's no way you can get into the defined benefit plan any longer. So it's been corrected.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I have a question. We have a 1A amendment, and I don't know if we wanted to proceed with this, what that does. I'm trying to find the packet. It's a technical amendment changing retired to terminated. She was terminated, so that would be the proper terminology. Okay.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
I'll move the 1A amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves the adoption of 1A. Discussion?
Do we have to move the bill first? Have you done
that? Oh, move the amendments.
Well, I was thinking we'd move the amendment and then move the bill as amended.
Yeah.
That works.
That'll
too.
Work. Yeah, because
that works.
To be incorporated in the omnibus bill. Any further discussion of Amendment 1? Oh, Senator Lynch. Amendment 1A. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, I think this makes sense. I'll move Senate File 1643, as amended, be included in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just, I failed to mention that we did monitor this, and from the time that the change was made in 02 and we closed this opening recently, there were 62 coordinated plan members who were given the option to retain that coverage. Of the 62, 32 chose to stay in the coordinated plan, 22 went to defined contribution, and the rest of them didn't join any plan. So there's potentially a couple dozen yet out there, but
possibly 32 more bills. But not tonight. Well, thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Vanek, maybe if you know who they are, you just may contact them at some point and say, before you do anything that's going to, you're going to regret, just, you know, talk to us and know your options. So, okay, thank you.
So she's not here. But his people are here.
Bill is here. Pepin is here. Pepin. Amar is off the.
Right. And Wardlow is here. Pepin? Joyce Pepin? Senator Representative Pepin? We'll get you to Maple Grove by 8:30.
Okay. Thank you very much.
House File 3242, Senate File 3127.
Ready?
Have to find it. Thank you. Yes, now we're ready.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair, excuse me, and members. With me tonight is Marilyn Arnland, and we both appreciate the opportunity to present this bill for your consideration. House File 3242 is a service credit transfer. I'll give you a little bit about the background, and then I will turn the mic over to Ms. Arnland. Ms. Arnland is a deputy fire marshal and fire inspector for the city of Maple Grove. She was hired by the city as a full-time fire inspector on April 2, 1990, and was covered by the PARA general plan until January 1, 1996. Even though Ms. Arnland did not change jobs on November 20, 1995, the Maple Grove City Council approved a resolution that made Ms. Arnland's position eligible for the PARA police and fire plan. During the time Ms. Arnland was in the PARA general plan, Ms. Arnland responded to daytime fire calls as a fire inspector, and as such, she should have been covered in the PARA police and fire plan. Jim Knutson, the finance director for the city of Maple Grove, in a letter to PARA dated May 7, 2007, and I believe this one is in your packet, he wrote, "I'm not sure why the city did not require PARA to change her classification status retroactive to her fire inspector start date. The duties for her position had not changed from 1990 to 1996. The city requests that Marilyn's start date for the PARA police fire plan be changed to April 2, 1990. The city understands that we will be responsible for the past due employer contributions, and the employee will be responsible for past due employee contributions." Members, this bill would allow Ms. Arnland to make additional member contributions equivalent to the difference between the PARA general and the PARA police fire member contribution rates, plus 8.5% compound interest. The city of Maple Grove would be required to pay the balance of the difference in the full actuarial value of the benefits for the 5.75-year period in which Ms. Arnland was covered under the PARA general. Now I'll turn the microphone over to Ms. Arnland for further detail.
Ms. Arman?
Arnland.
Arland.
Yes, Marilyn Arnland.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I would like to first of all thank Representative Pappin and Senator Lemon for helping me with this issue. I'd also like to thank Ms. Vanek with PARA, who is helpful in providing me with the costs to do this. I've been working on this issue regarding my pension for a number of years, and I am so happy to finally have it addressed. I was erroneously placed in the coordinated PURA fund when I should be placed in the police and fire fund. The city concurs and initially wrote a letter to PARA requesting to transfer my coordinated credit to the police and fire fund and wrote that they understood that they'd be responsible for past due contributions. PARA staff wrote the city back and explained there were no provisions in statute or policy that would allow it. The city then told me the only way to correct the error would be through special legislation. I understand that there's a cost to do this, and I'm willing to pay the amount. The city of Maple Grove agrees that I should have been placed there initially and supports my request and is also willing to pay their share of the cost and is aware of the amount to do this. As part of my job as fire inspector and now deputy fire marshal, I am a firefighter and a technician on the hazardous materials team with the city of Maple Grove. I respond to fire calls. I have done this as part of my employment since I was hired. Nothing has changed. The city of Maple Grove has sent a letter to Ms. Vanek providing proof of my job as a firefighter during the years I was in the coordinated PARA fund. I'd appreciate your support to get this resolved.
Okay. So you were then and you are now fighting fires?
Yes.
And then you just do fire inspection when you're not fighting fires?
I do fire inspections. I'm also a fire investigator. I'm on the hazmat team. I do public education. So when there's fire calls, we drop everything and go to fire calls.
Huh. Ms. Vanek? And Ms. Representative Pepin, then... It's your understanding that the city's willing to pay?
Excuse me?
The city's willing to pay
Yes, that is my understanding, Madam Chair, and I believe that there is a letter from the city's finance director included. And I think in both the packet that you handed out and then the packet we're testifying as well, Mr. Knutson from the city of Maple Grove.
Thank you. Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, members, Mary Vanek, para-director. Yes, we have been working with the city of Maple Grove for a long time on this, on not just Ms. Arnlin, but the whole issue of fire inspectors in the Police and Fire Fund. Fire inspectors do not qualify to participate in the Police and Fire Fund. And the only time that they are allowed to is if they, in fact, have a primary responsibility to respond to firefighting duties as part of their job. And so we look for that criteria. And, in fact, we have gone so far to ask for data on the number of actual fire calls that these fire inspectors, fire investigators will go on when there are these multifaceted positions, because the Police and Fire Fund is very limited to firefighters being included. We worked with the city of Maple Grove in the mid-90s, and at that point, the finance director then said it was at the point of the 95-96 change that they deemed, the city council deemed these folks firefighters and a primary responsibility in addition to their inspector jobs and put them in the Police and Fire Fund. We asked about the past service, and Ms. Arnlin, to her credit, she did ask us in 1996 how much of her coverage was police and fire, but we never, there was no follow-up on that. The current administration has now indicated to us that because of the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association there, and that the paid-on-call folks who are part of that are not available during the day, that they definitely rely on their paid full-time inspectors and folks in the fire department to respond to fire calls and feel that it is appropriate that they be covered in the Police and Fire Fund. The degree to which she did so in that 90 to 95 period, we don't have any, to be honest, good documentation on that, just the word of the individuals at the city. I spoke to Mr. Knutson on Monday. I did call him and say, are you going to be available Wednesday night? He said, I won't be there, Mary, but you can tell them that the city is neutral on this. If they pass this bill, we will pay this. We feel that these people deserve to be in the Police and Fire Fund. So that's what I can tell you. The cost to her, to, with the difference in contributions, is going to be about $25,300, and to the city is going to be an additional $47,000, roughly. We have not yet gone to the jointly retained actuary for the calculation. We did this ourselves, but we will go to the jointly retained actuary if this bill moves forward, because that does cost us money
would,
to do that.
Would you give us those estimates again to Mrs.
For Ms.
To
Arnlin?
Ms. Arnlin,
she would have to pay an additional $25,327, and the city would be billed for an additional $47,009 under our calculation.
And Mr. Knutson told you what?
Mr. Knutson said that the city was neutral on this bill and that if the Legislative Commission felt that it was appropriate to move it forward, the city would pay the bill that, that we would send to them.
Hmm. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vanek, is there any way for us to know, number one, in Maple Grove, if there are additional individuals in this circumstance, or are there individuals across many other departments that may see this as a precedence for a flood of these bills coming to us?
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, we do know the individuals in Maple Grove. We have worked very closely with the city administration over the last 10 years. And to my knowledge, based on what staff gave me today, all the current inspectors are in the Police and Fire Fund, and that those that are currently in, other than Ms. Arnlin, have coverage for all their service. With respect to other people in other communities, I am quite sure there are a lot of them out there. And I think that at some point in time, the issue of fire inspector coverage in the Police and Fire Fund is going to have to be addressed by the commission. And I don't know how many there are, Senator Larson. I just know that there are others.
If I could also add to that, I went through the roster.
Arnlin.
I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you. I went through the roster back in as far as I could go, it was in the early 90s, to see how many fire inspectors and fire marshals there actually were in the state of Minnesota back then. And my estimates, going through the roster and counting each person, is that the majority of those people were part-time back then. It was a very rare position that cities even had full-time fire inspectors and fire marshals in a lot of the cities. I estimated that there might be 25, maybe up to 40 fire inspectors and fire marshals in the state of Minnesota, but a lot of those were already in the police and fire fund, too. I guess there are probably 40 to 50% of them that I personally know were in the police and fire fund already.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you. Ms. Arnlin, just you're aware that the bill does provide that you have to make the authority to transfer the service credit. It expires on July 1st of 2009. So are you going to be able to make your share of the payment?
Yes,
in that
sir,
time?
I'm prepared to do that.
Okay, because we don't want you and Representative Pepin to come back next year and say
nope.
It didn't work. So, okay.
I'm prepared to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll move that House File 3242 be recommended to be included in the omnibus pension bill.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Wardlow, or Representative Wardlow.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I kind of miss you guys.
We miss you too, Representative Wardlow.
Although I'll get to go home sooner than you, I suppose. Anyway, I'm here. My name is Representative Lynn Wardlow from Egan District 38B, and I'm here with a fellow teacher, Cheryl Donnelly, who's a mathematics teacher at Apple Valley High School. She's taught there for 5 years, and she had a 4.188 years of service at Illinois that she'd like to buy back. And there's two things I want to note. One is that there is precedent for this. A Northfield teacher who previously had 11.2 years of service in Montana was allowed to buy back his or her teacher retirement. And also, in 2006, when this law that allowed buyback, when this law expired, Ms. Donnelly wasn't sure if she was going to live in Minnesota or go back to Illinois, so she didn't dare make that decision then. And now that she's decided to live here, she wants to buy it back. And I might add that her principal has told others that she's one of the best teachers in his department, in that mathematics department. And I want to keep her here. I'll let Ms. Donnelly make her testimony, and I believe you have a copy of it at your table.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Donnelly, welcome to the committee. Where are you teaching?
Apple Valley High School.
Okay. And we kind of understand the issue. You worked in Illinois. You want to buy that time back under Minnesota circumstances, right? And you've got loads of money, and so you're willing to donate it in.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Please make your statement.
My name is Cheryl Donnelly, and I'm a math teacher at Apple Valley High School. I want to thank you for this opportunity to present my concern. I'm grateful to live in a state of Minnesota where the concerns of the citizens are openly listened to. Thank you to the members of this commission that clearly values the people of Minnesota. I am privileged to have a job that I am passionate about. I have taught high school mathematics for the past 10 years. Every day I go to work, I feel that I'm positively contributing to society by encouraging students to love and be successful at mathematics, believing in their ability as individuals to become proactive and engage learners, enriching their lives with knowledge. As our nation and state continues to place importance on education, in particular the math and sciences, I feel that I daily contribute to this nationwide goal. I began my teaching career in the fall of 1998, working 4 years at Edwardsville High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. Upon meeting and marrying my husband, we moved to Minnesota in 2002, my husband's home state, so he could attend William Mitchell School of Law. In the fall of 2002, I began my job at Apple Valley High School, where I'm currently employed. I have a desire to transfer my 4 years of teaching in the state of Illinois into my Minnesota TRA. This will give me a total of 10 years of teaching in my retirement fund, helping me achieve my goal of retiring with at least 30 years teaching experience. In Illinois, at least 5 years of teaching is required to receive retirement benefits, including a monthly salary. Therefore, I'm short by 1 year to receive the benefits of my service. Minnesota, acknowledging my 4 years of experience that I brought to Apple Valley High School and allowing me to roll the money I've saved in my Illinois retirement account into the Minnesota's teacher's retirement account, would permit me to maintain one retirement fund that I'm fully invested in. I'm aware that the law had allowed me to do this expired in June of 2006. Previous to that expiration date, I called Minnesota TRA and discussed my options with them. I did not buy back my years then for simply one reason. My husband had just graduated from law school, and we were not positive we'd be staying in Minnesota to live near his family or moving back to Illinois to be by my family. In the past 2 years, we have become firmly settled in Minnesota, starting our own family, and now are certain that this is our home. Please consider my request to acknowledge and transfer my 4 years of teaching experience into my Minnesota teacher's retirement account. I understand that I will be fully paying for this out of my own pocket, and thank you for listening to my request.
Ms. Hacking? Or Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Luther Thompson, one of the assistant directors at the TRA. We've looked at this. The full actuarial cost of this is $11,811. As has been noted, this really conforms, to past commission policy. There is a precedent for it already, and TRA would not object since there's no adverse impact on TRA.
And Ms. Donnelly, you were aware.
Yes.
That you could buy back before 2006.
Yes.
But?
I just was not sure that we were going to stay here or move back to Illinois. And it costs money. You lose your interest every time that you roll it from one state to the next. You lose your interest. So I would lose about $4,000 to roll it from Illinois to Minnesota. So I didn't want to lose that unless I was 100% positive.
So did you pull your money out of Illinois?
So then in hopes that this would pass, I rolled my money over to 403B, my 403B, and it's waiting there. I'm hoping this will pass, and I can just roll it into the Minnesota Teachers Retirement Association.
How many more years do you have to teach?
Well, I would like to teach at least 30. I plan on making this my lifetime career.
All right. That's okay. What we need. Career teachers.
Okay.
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Senator Benson.
A couple of years ago, you and I and other members of this pension commission did spend quite a bit of time trying to figure out what the parameters are of the buyback, and we looked at a number of Vietnam-era veterans, who wanted to buy back their service, when they were unable to teach, and we talked about the Peace Corps, and those are the things that are outlined in here. But we had some concerns about that, and I think I can support what Ms. Donnelly has, but for Mr. Thompson, are we aware of other situations out there? Because, of course, as we know in this commission, every time we do something, somebody says, well, you did it here, so you know you got to do it here. So how many others in the pipeline might you be aware of where we have some other buyback? Because there's probably other teachers that are working in other states that are going to come home to Minnesota, and they would like to be able to do the same thing. And at some point, we're going to just have to set up some standards or policies so we're consistent from one case to the next.
I think, Madam Chair, Luther Thompson
Mr.
from PRA,
Thompson.
I do think it's a policy that should be revisited, and I think the issue is once it's established, it tends to grow into, here there's a pretty direct nexus between teaching and a state, and you try to encourage that and you encourage out-of-state trying to recruit out-of-state teachers or getting new good teachers wherever you can. And you're absolutely right. You know, there are many, many out, you know, there could be many out there. The issue becomes cost. In this case, because of the age of the member, it's relatively cheap for her to do it. If you have more senior teachers that are closer to retirement, the full actuarial value becomes very prohibitive. So it really depends upon the facts and circumstances. We do get inquiries on the military service, and there was a provision to allow them to buy back at full actuarial value, and when they look at the figures, they say, you haven't done us really any favors because it's very, very expensive. In this case, because of the age of the member, it's very close to what her contributions would have been here in that circumstance.
Well, and, yeah. Madam Chair and Ms. Donnelly, I do commend you for thinking of it now rather than coming to us 25 years from now and saying, you know, I did this Illinois thing years ago, and can I now buy it back? Because then you couldn't have afforded it. So I commend you for thinking ahead.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, the numbers that you gave us, the 11,000 something or another, 11,811, is that the actual amount of money?
Madam Chair, that's the full actuarial value for the 4.188 years if it's paid on June 30th, 2008.
Representative Wardlow.
Madam Chair, could someone move my bill, please?
Yeah. What happened to that? Madam Chair.
Don't rush us, Representative.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there. Madam Chair. And question for Ms. Donnelly, because we don't know, of course, when the bill will be passed and ultimately hope signed into law. But I'm assuming maybe around mid-April or late April, or it would be a time period. And if you have to make the transfer by June 30th, will you be able to do that within that time period?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. I'll move Senate House File 2762 be incorporated in the Omnibus Pension Bill.
Is there any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, members and Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney, Senate. That's, where is that? That's Torres Ray, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. And who do you have with you?
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. Representative Jim Dabney, I have with me tonight. Ms. Jean Johnstead, a constituent and longtime leader in the community. The issue before you in House File 2325 and Senate File 2213 is both very simple and very complex. Staff is good enough to bring around a packet that Ms. Johnstead is good enough to prepare for this evening's presentation. Ms. Johnstead was a member of the now former Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Association, MFTRA. At the time of her retirement in 1995, she was given either incorrect or misleading information in the form of a retirement benefits calculation by MFTRA staff. She was not provided, although requested, a fully documented projection of her retirement benefits until after the submission of her termination letter. She's very clear that had she gotten correct information at the time, she would have gladly continued to teach in the Minneapolis schools the length of time needed to meet the projections. She approached me just last year after learning in all possible ways through a letter to the editor in the Minneapolis paper that this commission exists and it was possible to pursue special legislation to respond to her concerns.
Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for giving us the opportunity to be here with our constituent. As you will hear from Ms. Johnston, what you will realize is that she made this decision really based on information that was provided to her, and it was wrong information. And as members know very well, these are decisions that are very complicated. To make these decisions, we really need to rely on the expertise of people who will give us the advice, who know these systems well enough to provide all the information that is necessary to make those decisions. And in her case, it is clear she has all the compelling evidence that will tell you that she was provided with the wrong information all along the way in her case, and she based her decision based on that recommendation that she was given. So I am here to ask for your support, Madam Chair, and for the members of the committee so that you hear her testimony and see clearly that she was given the wrong advice.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Johnston.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the commission, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight. I felt that this was something that I would not be able to do anything more about. I felt I had pursued it as far as it could be pursued, including hiring an attorney. However, it was clear to me that I could not afford to put more money into lawsuits, and that MFTRA was, as you can see from all the correspondence, not willing to discuss other options. I relied on the advice that I was given, as the representatives have explained, to my great detriment. And this became particularly problematic for me because I started teaching in 1961, and like the prior case that was just up here, I didn't have the opportunity to buy back things in various communities that I continued to teach in. My husband was a Pan American pilot, and we moved a lot, both in and out of the country. I taught, however, when he died and when Pan American went bankrupt, that pension disappeared as well. So my teaching pension became more important. So when I went down and talked to him, Mr. Bushlack, having followed all of his directions and gone to the board and turned in my resignation and backdated it as he instructed me to do, I was disappointed when he finally agreed to give me something in writing after I'd requested it several times, including with my financial planner, and there's an affidavit from him in there as in this stack as well. Basically, he said to me, well, it's not a big deal. I don't know why you're so upset. It's only $150. And I said to him, it's $150 a month for the rest of my life. So I'm here as my last shot at hoping that you would be willing to review the information and give me a decision that would hopefully make this a right, you know, outcome for me. And the principle that my attorney talked about was is stated on the second page, which is promissory estoppel. It's not the argument over the amount of money. It's the fact that, to my detriment, I relied on the staff person who was supposed to be an expert in giving me advice and who failed to do so.
And when did that take place?
That took place in 1995.
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Luther Thompson, representing TRA. First, I'll go over the cost of this proposal that we provided to the parties. The full cost, just you know, for the retroactive portion, $148 going back to the time of her retirement plus interest, is $56,472. The additional required reserves going forward for an additional benefit of $148 is $33,971. The total cost to TRA of this bill is $90,444. I think there's a number of issues that have been raised here, you know, by the parties. It is true that there was an appeal of this issue back in 1996. So, I mean, there are a number of legal issues. There's a number of questions of fact that certainly are still in dispute. I mean, they had a hearing back then. The member was represented by counsel from Briggs & Morgan. They were aware of the appeals process. They had a hearing in January of 1996. They had another hearing the following month. And based upon the information submitted, the Minneapolis Board denied the request. They did not have the authority to grant the benefit for which was requested. The benefit she's getting today is the exact benefit she's entitled to under the law, considering her service credit and her salary at that time. So the issue really revolves upon this issue of promissory estoppel. Within a month, I think a month after this case was heard, first of all, it was not appealed to the Court of Appeals, which was part of the appeals process. Her attorney was provided a copy of the Minneapolis appeals process back in 1996. Why they chose not to appeal it, you know, I don't know. Shortly after that, there was the Axelson case in Minneapolis, which said that promissory estoppel would not work if the entity did not have the authority to change the benefit. So I think, you know, that's a major issue. And I think the other issues that are raised here is the appropriateness of reversing an appeal by one of the pension fund boards. If we're going to do that, there seems to be a more thorough review of the legal theories that are being addressed here. Questions of fact, I mean, it's been disputed whether or not the original estimate was for 95 or 96. I have looked at, you know, the record. There clearly is a statement in there talking about the benefit in 1996. The issue was that shortly after the estimate was given to the member, was in a matter of a couple of weeks, the Minneapolis staff received a telephone call. And the question was, what if I decided to retire a year earlier? At that time, you know, he did not have the file available to him. There were a number of issues. If you retire a year earlier, you're going to have a reduction because your age is going to be 1 year earlier. There was an issue with the high five because when you went back 5 years, you had a different high five than in the earlier estimate. It just happened that fifth year was the year that the member was on sabbatical and never paid, you know, that back. So I think there's a number of issues that need to be addressed. And more significantly, most of the estimates that are paid, certainly by TRA, some by PARA, and not as often by MSRS, are based off estimates. You know, if the process is going to say you can't pay off an estimate and that members would rely upon those, you would have an issue about perhaps delaying a lot of annuity payments to members until you had the chance to audit the account. And at the time back in 96, I mean, they had paper files and it took a little bit longer to audit the accounts. But even now, for TRA, you know, it's probably 90 to 120 days. You know, PARA might be, you know, similar. And that would be certainly a difficult or a problematic issue for the pension funds to not be able to pay off estimates. But I think when you look at all the facts, and it's there's a number of issues here that would have to be addressed, I think before, you know, I think before it would be appropriate to overturn the decision of the Minneapolis Teacher Retirement Fund.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fetzel.
As Mr. Representative Dabney indicated, yeah, there's a lot of issues in here. This is quite complicated. And unfortunately, the Pension Commission is not really in a good position to be fact finders. You know, we're not able to, as courts do and administrative hearings, to be able to get the witnesses in, have them testify, kind of weigh, you know, the things, and then ultimately make a decision as to what we really think happened. And this is even more complicated by the fact that the fund, you know, that was in play is not the fund that is here today. I mean, Minneapolis Teachers no longer exists. It does seem a little odd to me, though, that, you know, we're asked to believe or rely upon what was said in a telephone call, and, you know, there's no way you can really verify that. But it's difficult to believe that, you know how somebody could have submitted retirement papers based upon what was said in a phone call. I mean, we've heard so many instances of people over the years saying, you know, I met with people, we've got letters exchanged and so forth, and we don't have anything like that. So I'm really uncomfortable trying to make a decision as to what did or did not happen under these circumstances. I feel bad for Ms. Johnstad that, you know, she may have been misled. And, you know, somebody may have told her something that was wrong, and now she has a reduced pension. But I think it does stand to reason, though, that, if you're going to work another year longer, your pension's probably going to get bigger. And if you retire now instead of working, you're going to get a smaller pension. I mean, at some point, you know, the numbers may not be what she thought they were going to be, but, she probably realized at some time that, you know, this was going to be, you know, an opportunity, and maybe she could have gotten more by working longer. So I feel really uncomfortable just trying to figure out what happened, but just what I know, I'm not quite ready to proceed with this particular bill.
Yeah. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would echo many of Senator Betzold's concerns, would further suggest that I think this has the potential to set a pretty strong precedent if we were to move forward with this, considering that, I mean, the real bottom line here seems to be that this individual is coming forward with this legislation tonight because I don't believe that I got good information or I didn't fully understand the information that was presented to me. Based on the potential precedent here, I am not comfortable supporting moving this forward.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm thinking of it maybe a little bit differently, but I'm looking at paragraph 4 on page 2 where it says a reversal would be appropriate if the determination of the governing board in the appeal was clearly erroneous or if the appeal process was sufficiently flawed so to invalidate its result. And I guess I'm just thinking that we'd have to have some proof, as this indicates, not that I'm questioning the word at all of the witness, but whenever we have already had a judicial decision made without anything, especially this much longer and this much after the fact, without some other evidence to substantiate that, it would seem to me that we'd be opening the door to just anybody being able to say, based on a misunderstanding or a miscommunication, and that's probably, I assume, what this was, some kind of miscommunication. It seems, though, that especially because this much time has passed since the initial decision was made, that we'd have to have some more information, as Senator Betzold said.
Any further discussion? Ms. Johnstad? Do you have a rebuttal for any of the statements that were made?
Madam Chair, if I may. One comment was that there were no witnesses at this point, and I was very careful and thorough in trying to make this decision. And when I talked to Mr. Bushlack, the MFTRA representative, the first time, I told him that I was thinking about retiring sometime in the future, and I wanted to know what it would be for 95, for 96, if I went back and taught one more year and told my students that I wouldn't be returning, or if I taught longer than that. He gave me two different figures, and that was for 96 and for several years following that. Clearly, I understood that the longer I taught, you know, because I knew how much it had hurt me to move in my career every time that had happened and I started at the bottom. But what happened is my next step then to make sure I was making a good decision was to meet with my financial planner. And with my financial planner, and he had provided an affidavit that's in this packet, he did ask questions about that, and we also said at that point, If I retired now, what would it be? You know, and Mr. Bushlack at that point sort of guesstimated that he agreed that it would probably be about 10% less than the $541 number he had given me. So that was what we used to base that on, and I kept asking for it in writing, and he said he couldn't do that until he had a definite retirement date. And so I followed his explicit instructions. And even though it was August, he told me that I should backdate my retirement to the 30th of June so that I would get the COLA increase. And I felt he was looking out for my best interests, and I followed exactly what he told me to do to my detriment. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. There's no motion before us, and so that means we are not going to consider this further.
Thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Greiling. House File 2803. Ms. Greiling. Representative Greiling, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, very much. I do have an amendment to this bill. I don't know if you want someone to move it first or for me to go through the bill. My constituent is on vacation.
I hope it's someplace warm.
It is.
Okay. Why don't you tell us what the bill is about first?
Okay, well, what the bill basically does, and I imagine that many of you are familiar with this because according to Mr. Martin's memo, it's come up a couple other times, and these situations have been approved. My constituent is a faculty member, adjunct faculty member at Metro State, and she wanted to be in TRA, but she hadn't worked enough hours there. So when she finally qualified, she went to Human Services, and her testimony, by the way, is in your packet. She went to Human Services, and they told her she had missed the chance because she hadn't met the deadline, and so by default, she was in the default coverage, which would be the IRAP coverage. And she forever can't ever make that choice to go back. But no one could come up with any verification that she'd been notified, and she would tell you if she's here, and it does say in her testimony that that she wasn't notified. So we are now here with this bill to follow along with a couple other cases you have considered to have her have that opportunity, and she's willing to pay her share of the cost. And that basically is it. And the amendment is from Luther Thompson because some of the dates she provided to Mr. Martin were a little bit off, and this is to get the dates right.
Mr. Thompson? Is there somebody from Minsky here that's prepared to talk? Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Luther Thompson representing TRA. First off, the full actuarial cost of electing TRA coverage in this case is $15,116.
Oh, you go so fast when you read those.
Okay.
Tell me that number again.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. The actuarial cost of electing TRA coverage in this case is $15,116.13. And this is supposed to be, it'll be a really a rollover of what's in her IRAP account, and it's based upon the employee and the employer share there. And once that IRAP is fully rolled over, the employee and employer additional share, the employee share will be $2,499.99, and the employer share will be $4,925.28. Are we okay?
Well, Lisa's got them down, so we're okay.
This is the second. We had another case similar to this. I believe it was 2 years ago, the Shelley Siegel case that really was sort of a longer period of time, but that was also one of the missing card cases. And I think Minskew will testify. They don't think there's too many more of these, but in this case, she really was getting service and PERA at the same time. So, I mean, TRA will not be hurt since this is the full actuarial value. But I think it goes, you know, there's another issue about, the default option, particularly for people that have prior service in the funds, the defined benefit funds, and particularly those that were, similar to this case. But in this case, it is consistent with the commission principles. There were other precedents, exactly the Shelley Siegel case, and it's based upon full actuarial value. And because it was based, there's no proof or evidence that she was ever offered the election, TRA would not oppose this bill.
I don't have your name.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mary Millar. I'm with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Office of the Chancellor Human Resources Division. And we did ask the two institutions who had hired Ms. Mosby if they would research their records. They could not find that she had indeed been provided with the notice of her right to elect TRA, that she had defaulted into IRAP, and we would not object to this actuarial purchase. Okay.
So TRA says okay, and Minskew says okay, and Ms. Millar, is the amendment that we have in our packet the same one that Ms. Greiland was talking about, Representative Greiland was talking about? Or Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, we agree with the amendment. It was a part of the attachment, I believe, of the materials, unless there was a...
Is that 1A?
Yeah.
The 1A amendment?
Right.
Oh, here it is.
Madam Chair?
Right.
Senator, I'm trying to engross the 1A amendment on House File 2803, and it's not seeming to work. It says, page 1, line 16, delete first and insert later. I'm looking at page 1, line 16... was later employed in exit. I don't full time, but I don't. I'm not sure if this is all lining up here.
Ms. Millar?
Madam Chair, Senator Bretzel. Our statute actually states that an employee first becomes eligible for coverage in their retirement fund when they are at or over 25% time employment. And actually, Ms. Mosby did not become employed at 25% until August 27th of 2005. So,
Madam Chair, my question is, we have a 1A amendment here, and it says delete first and insert later, and maybe it's the other way around. I don't know.
It should be.
She was first employed at 25% time on August 27th, 2005. prior to that, she was always under 25%.
How should the amendment read?
Right.
Members, I think the problem is that the first and the latter were reversed.
Okay.
Yeah. That the word we're deleting is latter, and the word that we're inserting is first. And I apologize that some my dyslexia or something caused this problem.
And Madam Chair.
So it should be delete later and insert first. Okay. In line one, line or page one, line 16.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, then the next lines 1.3 and 1.4 on the way in A amendment. Delete excess of.
That's not in there.
And delete. I can't figure out on line 17. I don't know where that fits.
Line
16. Madam Chair. 16. Excess of line 16. Yeah.
Okay. We need it.
Sorry.
Good catch.
Mr. Martin.
I think the real key here is probably the page 2, line 14 amendment, which is setting the purchase period or the period where she's going to change the date when the coverage transfer would occur. Perhaps if we strip the amendment down to just the page 2, line 14 amendment at the moment, the balance of it is to make sure we have a description of her correct. We can get that as we move along in the process. And rather than spend your time trying to figure out, I think what happened is that the bill, the initial version of the bill is maybe what I used to draw the amendment from incorrectly rather than the revisor's version, and something bobbled upstairs.
Okay.
And so I think we can get this straightened out, but I think the real key is to make sure that we get the right date. And according to Minsky records, she was not eligible to elect any coverage till she hit the 25% threshold. That didn't occur until August of 2005, rather than the constituent's memory of sometime in 2004. And so I think if you do the page 2, line 14, you've got the key legal impact change that needs to be made and would be best made here. The rest we can get as we go.
Madam Chair, I have a hunch we're going to have a technical amendment at some point along the way. So I will move on the 1A amendment, line 1.5 of the 1A amendment. I think that's the one point we need to have in the bill. So just that part.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of line 1.5 without the page and line. Oh, I guess that is the page and line, too.
Yeah.
Yes. Just adoption of 1.5.
Correct.
Of Amendment 1A. Is that okay with you, Ms. Millar?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question I have for Ms. Millar or Mr. Luther would be, how many more of these time bombs might be out there ticking that could happen? And is there a way that we could go and check that out before and deal with them or figure it out beforehand?
Ms. Millar.
Madam Chair, Representative, without going through every single employee, of which there are thousands and thousands, and asking every one of our institutions to check their records, we would have no way of knowing that.
But former Representative Stanton, representative of the IFO, has a solution in another bill, perhaps. That's coming later.
Okay.
But not just
addressed to Ms. Mosley. So,
I'll renew my motion on the 1A amendment, line 1.5.
Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And Madam Chair, then I'll move House File 2803, as amended, be included in the omnibus pension bill.
Any further discussion? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling. Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I apologize. I hope I didn't hold up your agenda. I actually have driven 75 miles in the last hour and managed to make it back. I hope my name wasn't called previously, but I appreciate your time this evening. With me tonight is William Klobunder, a Inver Grove Heights resident, former City of St. Paul employee. Mr. Klobunder has injuries so severe to his shoulders as a result of his work, undisputed injuries, I might add, that he qualified for Social Security disability on his first try. And I say that's an important point because nobody qualifies for Social Security disability on their first try. It's usually, as you know, about their third effort. What happened is when he lost his job as a result of his injuries, he went seeking benefits. And the normal course would have obviously been to get disability benefits. Unfortunately, he received literally no counseling to that point. He was handed a form to get his benefits, signed the form, which was a waiver of disability benefits so that he could get early retirement. He took his early retirement and off he went. And I know for you folks, you know, disability benefits and so forth is kind of an easy and straightforward topic, but I think you'll recognize it for lay people, it probably is not. At the same time he got that form, which I might add he then took to the bank to sign in front of a notary public, again receiving no counseling on what the effect of that form was, he signs the form. At that time he was under the effect of medications. He was suffering from stress and depression, clinically diagnosed, which is in your materials. So not in a position where he could make his best decision, and you couple that with a total lack of any counseling on the impact of this decision. So he goes through, he gets early retirement benefits, doesn't even go through the disability process, that because he doesn't know he's even eligible for that possibility. He goes through SSD, he's heard of that, qualifies, like I say, on the first try, and then it comes to light that, in fact, you know, he gets off the medications, stress, depression are behind him. And he comes to learn that, in fact, what he should have done was apply for his disability benefit. And he literally would have gotten, it's not a huge amount of money, but he would have gotten a few hundred dollars more a month. I think it's $400, $300 or $400 more a month. And that's the situation we're in. I would cite to you the case that was approved for West St. Paul firefighter in 2002. This case is so much stronger than that. And that case was approved. In that case, there is no reference to a lack of counseling. There is no reference to medication, stress, and depression impacting the ability to make a decision. And the disability apparently was nowhere near as severe as this one, where Mr. Klobunder literally qualified on his first try for Social Security disability. And on that basis, particularly citing that precedent of the West St. Paul case, on which this is light years beyond that, Mr. Klobunder would request that he have the ability to revoke that early retirement and then apply for his disability benefits so that he can receive literally just a few hundred dollars more per month. And that's on behalf of myself and Senator Metz, and we appreciate your support, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Mr. Klobunder.
Yes.
Do you have a statement to make?
Pretty much what he already said. I haven't worked since 2006, May 9th. I worked for 6 hours on August of that year, and realized that I couldn't do it, and being pretty much uneducated, just doing labor work all my life, I become severely depressed and seen a therapist. They had me on different medications. I stayed in the house. I didn't do much, but I went down there. They gave me the forms. They said, fill it out. Get it notarized. I did that. I got all through that. The city let me go. They gave me offered me a year's salary to quit, and that's what I did because they knew I couldn't do it anymore. And 6 months later, after I got off the medication and everything, I found out about the disability, and I went down back to Para, and the man I seen, I don't remember his name, but he said that you should have been explained to you about the disability, and it never was, and I asked him, well, what can I do, and that's why I'm here. Okay. He told me to go through my senator.
And you did?
Yes, yes I did, ma'am.
And Representative Atkins, are you asking for our consideration of the disability as the disability law was at the time of his injury or as the disability law today?
Madam Chair, if I actually, I think it's even simpler than that. He needs to be able to revoke his early retirement, the election of his early retirement. And then he's got to go through the process of having his disability claim granted. I don't believe that we're here before this body to have that done. He'll have to do that, and that's Mr. Martin discussed that in his memo. Mr. Klobunder, he realizes he's kind of playing with fire here because he's going to have to get that approved. But shoot, folks, if he got approved under Social Security Disability Guidelines on his first try, I think it's pretty, we can say with some confidence, he's going to be able to get his disability benefits under the policy to which he's entitled to get those benefits. But he can't do that without being first able to revoke his early retirement, which is the option that he selected, and undo that waiver that he signed when he was on the medications and under stress and depression.
Thank you. Ms. Vanek.
I left that chair for you, Mary.
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek for the record. I looked at this case very carefully, and what our records indicate is that Mr. Klobunder called our office on November 21st, 2006, and asked for a retirement application. And we provided that information, and the retirement application was received in our office on December 20th, along with a termination verification form and all the documentation to move forward. The only indication we have in our records that he had any health or medical issues was one pay period where he was reported on workers' compensation leave of absence or medical leave of absence. Otherwise, he had ongoing contributions reported. So generally, if the staff in calculating the benefits sees something unusual, they would question it, but there was no real reason to question it with one pay period involved here. We have no indication he asked for disability information. I do have copies of the personal benefit statement. We send out an annual statement to our members, and we do include disability information, and that was on all of his statements. The only one that didn't have a dollar estimate was his final one in 2006 because of his. If there's any break in service whatsoever, we don't give an estimate. We ask them to call us. So I don't know who he encountered when he was in the office. I know that he came in through our phone center, and the phone representative took the request for retirement application. I understand that he's very frustrated with us, but we have hundreds of people retire early every year, and if we asked everybody, why are you retiring early? Do you know about disability? We could be processing a lot of paperwork that would never qualify. He is on our coordinated plan, which is a total and permanent disability, not our police and fire plan that is an occupational disability test. So it's much more stringent, and I'm not saying that he, you know, couldn't go through the process. I'm just saying that the disability standard is much stiffer. So we don't ask that question of people automatically when they call and say, I'm retiring, send me a retirement application. Why he did not see a counselor if he was in our office, I don't know. I can't explain that. Nobody could recall him, you know, that interaction when he came in.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Well, and again, as I understand, the request here, as Representative Atkins indicates, he's asking to apply for disability benefits. We're not making the decision that he is or is not disabled. He may apply, and they may decide that if they look at his application and actually decide that, yes, he was disabled, then it would be appropriate, I guess, to let him proceed. And if they turn him down, well, you know, then they turn him down. So, you know, I guess I'm, under the circumstances, willing to at least, you know, let him file his application, because he could have filed a disability application anyway. Where it would have gone, you know, I have no clue, and I'm not even going to even suggest where it might have gone. But, you know, as long as this is not the final step, he has to prove his case. You know, I don't see any harm in letting him do that. Now, you know, I hope he doesn't cite the fact that the commission, if the commission decides that, you know, we're going to let him do this, to say, well, he must be supporting his position, because I don't think we're taking any position on that. But anyway, that's kind of how I'm seeing it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is my concern. We haven't had in place up to this point an affirmative requirement for counseling. And so if that's going to be a reason to go back and redo, and his request to go back and reconsider the election that was made at that time, I'm seeing as no different than anyone else's request to kind of back up and then and make a different decision than the decision that was made at the time. So it would seem to me that if we're going to allow that to happen, a couple of the things that Representative Atkins said, for example, just kind of puzzled me. For example, you said that he had this document notarized and no one counseled him at that time. Well, that's not a notary's job to counsel a person about the document that they're signing. So, you know, I guess I'm worried that in the absence of something special about this case, that because we haven't ever done this before, apparently, that anyone is going to be able to say they didn't get this counseling, so now they should have a reconsideration to be able to change the election that they made at the time. So that leads me to ask, I guess, Representative Atkins, Madam Chair, whether the Social Security disability, which I agree with Representative Atkins, that's not an easy thing. I used to represent those people, and I know how tough that is. Was there anything in that Social Security disability finding, because just based on a shoulder injury, I'm surprised he'd be considered 100% disabled, maybe, unless it was that severe. So maybe there was something about, was the stress a part of that would have led us to believe that he wasn't maybe competent at the time to be making that decision? Because it kind of seems like that's where you're going with some of this. But I'm just wondering if there's any medical findings or anything that would substantiate that.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson. If I might, Madam Chair, just on the first point, it certainly wasn't my intent to point a finger of neglect or any sort of blame on the folks. It's more of a matter of equities, and that the fact is that there was no counseling, there was no, and it's not saying that there's literally an affirmative action. It's just to give them the opportunity to go through the disability process that he didn't even know he had a right to go through at the time. And I made the point about him going to the bank. Obviously, you don't get any counseling from a notary public. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, when he was signing the form, that there wasn't an understanding of members that he was in front of somebody that might have been in a position to offer him advice either. As far as the disability, my understanding is it literally was in the shoulders. I'd let Mr. Klobunder give you an indication in terms of the severity of the injury and why it was granted on the first time by Social Security.
Well, when I started at the city,
Mr. Klobunder.
Pardon me?
Mr. Klobunder.
Thank you. I'm a little nervous. But in 1999, I shoveled 15 to 18 tons of asphalt a day, which had a machine, a paving machine, could do it. I did that in 2000 again, and that's when my shoulders started getting bad. I seen two specialists after in 2006, and they said I have severe tendonitis and they cannot fix it. There's nothing they can do. And that's when the city let me go. And so I applied for Social Security, and they gave it to me. Is that the answer? And the depression was really bad. I would have signed anything at that point because I didn't really know what was going on in the later part of 2006 and 2007, and it shows in that paperwork. Did I answer the question correctly?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess, sir, I guess I was just wondering if the depression that you're talking about would have been documented in the Social Security records, something so that, you know, so that we're not setting a precedent that would seem to imply that if there wasn't an affirmative action taken, that that's kind of opening the door to other people going back and reversing.
I had to send all my paperwork to the doctors, to Social Security. But at that point when I filed for Social Security, I wasn't depressed. Is that what you mean?
Madam Chair, I think there's documents in the packet about the depression.
I was on...
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that the application contained an explicit waiver with regard to the disability benefits. And it's been suggested that, and one can presume that that explicit waiver statement was contained on the form, probably because of there was some point in time that was felt that there was a need to do that. And so I'm just wondering if it's has been the precedent of the commission or the practice of the commission to disregard those explicit waivers.
Madam Chair, if I might, to that very
Atkins.
Issue, because I suspected that point would be sort of a linchpin for this matter. There is, first off, there's precedent based on that West St. Paul case. This body set a much lower standard, which Mr. Klobunder's situation far exceeds. With respect to that form, the point, and it's demonstrated by the medical documents, is that he was in a position in his life where he's on medication, he's suffering stress and depression. So that is a very unique and specific to this case situation, where he's not in a position to have the sort of capacity necessary to sign a form. Together, or coupled with the fact that there's no counseling to that point. As he says, he would have signed anything at that point. He was just trying to get his benefits and didn't realize that he was waiving literally the possibility of a few hundred dollars more each month.
And Representative Atkins, how did he find out he's not getting the few hundred dollars more a month that he could have gotten?
Somebody told me, Madam Chair, somebody told me in about June of 2007 that I should have filed for disability, and I said, disability? I didn't know anything about disability. That's when I went to PARA, and the man at PARA that I talked to said that I signed a form saying that I couldn't file for disability, and I didn't realize it because I was so screwed up in December of 2006.
Ms. Vanek, have the other people come to the PRA board and said, can they change?
Madam Chair, yes, we have that happen from time to time, not very often. Staff is usually pretty good. When people do ask to see a counselor, they do talk about these things. And usually people do share their health or medical issues if they're coming in for early retirement, if that's what's driving their early retirement. But we do not go out and specifically ask that question. When I did education prior in my prior life at PERA, in the education programs, I always advise people, if you are leaving because of a health issue, make sure you ask to talk to somebody at PERA and find out where you can. But, you know, we don't reach everybody. But for the record, I would like to make it clear that the difference in monthly benefit is $160, not $400. So it's a matter of a beginning benefit of about $232 a month versus $392 a month.
Say those numbers again, please.
His retirement annuity was $232 a month. Now, there was a little more added on because he took a supplement we pay, but
the absolute annuity was $232 a month, and the disability benefit would have started out at $392 a month had he gone through that process. So I just want to make the record clear, it wasn't several hundred dollars a month. And if we allow this to happen, and he filed, and then the difference would—he's not getting that $160 extra, $160 a month now. Would you expect that that would be retroactive then, Representative Atkins?
Madam Chair, I hope so, but I don't know. It's an excellent question, but I think we were going to try to reflect that in the bill that, in fact, it would be, but I don't know from the language that that was...
That's retroactive.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Thiessen. You're all... So, I appreciate Ms. Vanek's clarifying, but literally for Mr. Klavender, not to get too much into his personal situation, but that $160 will make an enormous difference to him.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, I would like to draw attention to line 2.10 to 2.1. This says that if, in fact, he's determined to qualify for the disability benefit, that we do pay the lump sum difference for the past months, but it includes interest at 8.5%. We have historically never paid interest on an underpaid benefit. That money has been moved to the post-retirement fund and is there in a different capacity than in our active fund, and so it literally pays more. We are not under statute allowed to collect interest on overpayments when the people have to pay them back, nor do we pay interest on underpayments. So I would respectfully ask that that be stricken.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bethel.
I believe, and I'll need some help on this one, on page 2, line 10, if we delete everything after the comma, starting with the comma, all through lines 11 and 12 through the period, would that would delete? So I'd so move, Madam Chair. Page of the bill, page 2, line 10, delete everything starting with the comma through the rest of that line, line 11 and line 12 through the period. That would eliminate the interest payment.
Any further discussion on that point? If not, Senator Bensel moves to delete after the comma from plus and on line 210 and all of 211 and all of 212. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have is for Mrs. Vanek. Dealing with, you said that you didn't notice that he only had 1 week that he was on workers' compensation, gone because of workers' compensation, and otherwise he was having payments in. I guess the question I have, maybe it's for Mr. Klavender also, Klavender, anyway. Were you off on sick leave and collecting sick leave benefits, recruit sick leave? Is that why you weren't getting workers' comp?
I was.
Or were you only off that 1 week?
Mr. Klavender.
Yes, Madam Chair. I can prove that I was on workman's comp from May 2006. They have a thing where you can put sick leave in with it, and then you still get your health insurance and things with it. But I can prove to the committee here, if they'd like, that I've been on workman's comp up until December of 2006, from May all the way through. I can prove that if you want.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
That's what I wanted to find out, because having worked in the public sector, I know they do that sometimes, and so it looks so you could, again, continue your health insurance. I guess the follow-up question I have for Ms. Vanek is, if you had known, if you had come in and known he was a bet on workers' comp for almost a year ahead of time, would somebody have noticed that and then automatically it said, you know, we should look at this? And
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, there is a period matching his description of lower salary for that for beyond May 06. And yes, absolutely. If the city would have reported that the salary was lower because he was on workers' compensation, we would have immediately asked questions about that.
Sarah Olson.
I'll move Senate or House File 3311.
As amended.
As amended. Be recommended to be included in the omnibus bill.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Thank you.
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, is this number 11?
Number
14.
Number 14. This one's 14.
Okay. Could I do number 11? Commissioner Johnson is here.
I'm sorry. Senator Betzold.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Randy Johnson, actually, when you look around the commission, five of the members of this commission represent part of Hennepin County. And I used to represent part of Hennepin County, so I think he's known to some of the commission members here. I met with him over the interim on an issue that he can describe here, but he went into, when he began his public service as a Hennepin County commissioner, he went into the defined benefit plan. He would like to go into the defined contribution plan. Defined contribution to benefit, okay. Okay, I reversed that. I'm sorry. And not so much for his own benefit, but for his wife. And he's willing to pay the full actuarial value. And he, as he explained to me, if he and his wife die in a plane crash, then the fund's going to make out quite well. But I'll let him explain his own case.
Been flying a lot or what?
Actually, he just came in from D.C.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill. I've been very honored and privileged to have served people of Hennepin County as Hennepin County Commissioner for almost 30 years now. And as Senator Betzold pointed out, that this bill would allow me to purchase from the service credit from the General Employee Retirement Plan via transfer from my PERA defined contribution plan. I want to stress that the purchase would be at the full actuarial value. Mr. Martin's memo points out that there are few, if any, elected officials with the length of service, local elected officials approaching 30 years. And the way politics are going, I'm not sure there are ever going to be very many more. Mr. Martin's memo also points out that there are numerous precedents for approving previous purchase of service credit at full actuarial value, including purchases by local elected officials. My wife, who taught in Eden Prairie schools for 33 and a half years, took early retirement from teacher's retirement last year, and this prompted me to look at my situation.
So her retirement prompted you to look at this, and that's why, because my question was, why did you wait till now? So, and it's in PRA, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Ms. Vanek? Have we had any similar circumstances?
Oh, Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek. No, Madam Chair, we have not. We looked at the participation in a defined contribution plan, and There are several people who have large account balances, but none of them as significant as Commissioner Johnson's, nor with as many years of service. When the defined contribution plan was enacted in 1990, there was a provision that allowed folks to purchase their past elected service if they hadn't participated in our retirement plan. So they could buy into the defined contribution plan for all their past service, and he did that going all the way back to 1979. That is not available to new folks who come in. So if they've got past service from 90 forward, they can't buy in. But that was an option at that time for the newly created defined contribution plan. And when I looked at the number of counts, his 29 and a half years of service is, you know, beyond most others. The closest one is another Hennepin County commissioner at 19 years. But most of them are between 5 and 9 years length of service in that they participated in defined contribution. When the defined contribution plan was enacted, it really, I think, wasn't anticipated that folks would have that length of service and that much of that amount of contribution in the fund coming in. We have a program that both actuaries have reviewed that where we can on staff calculate actuarial purchases. But as an additional measure for this particular case, I did go to our consulting actuary, and she confirmed that our calculator was, you know, still up to par, and the cost on strictly a basis of his pension for that period of time would be $422,196. I was concerned, however, because our plan subsidized the bounce back. People who take a joint and survivor option don't have to pay extra to have that opportunity to bounce back up to their normal, their highest annuity payment if the survivor who was named to be the recipient beyond the member's lifetime, if that person dies first, the member can bounce back up to the full value. And so that does have a cost to the plan. And so we further calculated that if Commissioner Johnson were to take a 50 or 100% joint and survivor option on his benefit, there would be a slightly higher cost to PERA. So I just wanted to disclose that additional information. I also, with all due respect to him, I do have to be concerned that I know that we haven't done a mortality assumption change for two experience studies now, and with the next experience study, we always are on notice that we make adjustments every 2 to 3 experience studies in our mortality. And so I asked our actuary to say, if we made that adjustment, you know, I know you can't tell me what table you the actuaries would be recommending, but what kind of an impact. So she did use that also. So I just wanted to make sure that we had full disclosure of the impact of PERA if you grant this, because this is really unusual. This is the first time we've had somebody ask, with that length of service particularly, asked to move from the defined contribution to the defined benefit plan.
And Madam Chair, you'll note there's an email that Ms. Vanek sent to Mr. Martin and copied me, and there's also an A1 amendment, which, and maybe Mr. Martin can explain, but I'm assuming that if this is granted, the intent was to have Commissioner Johnson start contributing to PERA, the coordinated plan, and then because we don't know, I guess his term is up this year, but whether he's going to run again or whatever, we don't need to know that right now, but I guess we would want him to start paying in. And is that, Mr. Martin, is that what the amendment does there?
Senator, that's my understanding of the PERA our concern that what happens if there's a gap between when he makes this purchase and he ultimately terminates his public career, and if that gap is fairly long, there's a potential problem. And then they also wanted to shorten up the deadline. The deadline in the bill for making this purchase was sometime in 2009, and they wanted it the end of 2008. So the 1A amendment does both.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Commissioner Johnson, is the deadline, the new deadline of 2008, is that doable then for you then?
That would be doable, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that would be doable.
I'll move the 1A amendment just to make that correction to the bill.
This amendment, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Yeah.
The amendment I'm looking at says one before December 15th, 2007, and the other after January 1st, 2008, and before January 31st, 2008?
No.
Is that the right, or is that the wrong amendment?
Wrong packet.
Oh, wrong. I'm on the wrong one. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of the 1A amendment to House File 3696, Senate File 2424. Is there any additional discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And further, Madam Chair, when he agreed to carry the bill, we did ask Ms. Vanek to look into the fact that were there other similar situated people out there who had long service that may want to move from one plan to the other, and apparently there just doesn't seem to be anybody on the rise. And you mentioned Hennepin County, but I thought there might be other situations. I can think of a situation in Anoka County, long tenured commissioner, but he's already taken care of, and there may be others around the state, but you didn't find any. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, some of those that we were aware of, when we checked our records, they're already in the defined benefit plan. They had the opportunity to opt in, and they did so when they were elected, and so they're already there.
Okay.
Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate File 2424 be incorporated in the omnibus bill. As amended.
As amended.
As amended. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Quick question. It seems that long service is being the kind of a distinguishing factor here from a whole variety of other things. I'm just would like some clarification on why that is a relevant factor in distinguishing this case.
Mr. Martin?
I think the long service members has to do with the actuarial value and the potential liability of the pension fund. Someone who's purchasing a very short period of time has a very nominal effect on the pension fund, plus has a smaller actuarial value. This is a longer career and has a greater value and a greater liability for the pension plan.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure that answered my concern, but that's all right.
Madam Chair. Do you want to try, Senator Betzel?
No.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'm just thinking it's just the opposite of the earlier school teacher earlier that's doing it when she's young. That is a small figure. And if she had done it after 30 years, it would probably be a figure somewhat similar to this.
Not knowing the salary of the school teacher or the salary of the county commissioner in the broad terms, yes. But I.
And Madam Chair, I guess my question,
Representative Thiessen,
is simply, I get that piece that it costs more money if you're way longer. But if we're trying to distinguish this case from other people that want to switch from a defined benefit to a defined contribution, what does longevity have to do with that? That's my question, because that appears to be part of the argument. I just want to clarify that, at least for the record, if that's going to be how we're distinguishing this case from all future cases.
Well, and
or maybe I'm missing a lot.
Senator Betzel.
I think it's, if anybody's going to go in one direction, it would be from, I want to make sure I get it right, defined contribution of benefit, right? I mean, I don't think many people would want to go the other direction. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Martin?
Members other than the Rochester city council member we just dealt with earlier tonight.
But that,
who wanted to be able to retire for other employment, want to be in the defined contribution plan.
Okay.
I think it depends on.
I'm not sure
the market and the year.
Yes.
Members, I'm not sure that the long service has much to do with this, other than it's fairly rare to have someone who comes in and purchases essentially an entire career in one fell swoop. But that's an unusual circumstance. I'm not sure I understand how that weighs into the argument either way, other than it's a very unusual circumstance.
Okay.
So, Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, I think that weighs in on this one only because he actually did contribute to the defined contribution plan all the way back. So all of that service had a contribution to the defined contribution plan. And
In his particular case, the defined contribution plan account, although I looked at it today, it's declined a bit, was sufficient to make the transfer of funds to the defined benefit plan and cover this cost. My concern would be that because most of the other accounts I've looked at are like half of the value of his, that I hope that we don't go the direction of letting that account value purchase an annuity with the PERA coordinated plan, or see what it, you know, see what it buys, or if they want to buy all their service and then have to deal with, well, how are they going to come up with the extra money? Because it, as you can see, this is a very expensive benefit. Yeah. So that's one caution I would.
So this, want to represent,
so this clearly is a very unique case, yep, for purposes, and we're taking notes on all of that.
I think it's very extraordinary.
And Madam Chair, I'm sure you know this might address some press attention too. Ms. Vanek, do we have any estimate on how much this is going to cost in order to have the buyback?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that letter from Mercer gives you the cost. It's $422,000 on a peer under the current actuarial calculation.
Okay, here it is.
And with all due respect, I forgot to call the reporter back. Not intentionally. I just was really busy, and I have had a press call on it already. I just didn't get to it.
Okay.
It's hard sometimes.
Yes, it is.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I apologize if I'm being dense about this too, but I guess what I understand that this is a unique case because of the amount of money involved. But just in terms of the rationale for allowing this, is what's being said here that basically anyone who wanted to could make this switch because it would hardly ever happen that someone would ask? Or what is it about this case that makes it a situation where we wouldn't be setting a precedent for anyone who wanted to? Just, I mean, you'd think it would be more likely for someone and when they have a lower cost, but if the cost doesn't really make any difference in the precedent, then is it just the rule that if anyone wants to make the switch, they can, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that's something that we all need to explore going forward, because this plan was created in 1990, and for individuals who are in, particularly in the metro area, who have higher career-type salaries on which they're contributing, we need to have that discussion. Are we at a point in the history of this defined contribution plan that that's something that we want to consider? Because in its current structure, we simply pay out a lump sum, and if an individual goes to an insurance company and wants that lump sum rolled there to purchase an annuity, we do that. But we have not structured it like the state plan, where you can move from the defined contribution plan to a traditional benefit through our system. This is the first.
Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, I'll renew my motion to incorporate Senate File 2424 into the omnibus bill, as amended.
Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we have a bunch of people here from Minneapolis that go home if we could do their thing. If there's any other big group of people waiting.
Gee. You want us to be lonely? Is that which one?
That's 16, I think.
Oh, that one. Okay, number 16, Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, this is, I had some hearing on this before. This is a resolution of the Pension Commission to change the mortality assumptions for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association, and they haven't been updated for quite a long time.
Welcome.
Good evening.
I'm Larry Ward, president of the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. Madam Chair and distinguished members of the commission.
You've been waiting a long time to come before us.
Yes, we have. And this issue has been waiting a long time also. At this time, we're asking the commission to change our mortality assumption table. The last review of this table was approximately 30 years ago. The longer we wait to address this problem, the greater the pension liability becomes to the city of Minneapolis. We are the only public safety group in the state of Minnesota that has not changed its mortality table. The simple fact is pensioners are living longer. Addressing this issue will present a better understanding of our fund's liability. In previous discussions with the city of Minneapolis, they have indicated that they have budgeted 2010 for this mortality issue. Our board, after much discussion, has agreed to accept this date. At this time, the technical aspects of this, we have our actuary here, Mark Meyer, and any questions on that mortality table, I think Mr. Meyer will be able to answer, and any further questions to me, I'd be happy to answer.
And Madam Chair,
just
to give some comfort to the city here, we're looking at Resolution 08-1, and I would like to offer an amendment to that. At the end of the resolution, it's an oral amendment, but it's to add the words, for valuations prepared after July 1st, 2008. And that will make it effective in the 2010 budget for the city of Minneapolis.
For valuations?
Prepared after July 1st, 2008. And that will be a valuation that comes out in May of 2009. And then it'll be effective for 2010.
For valuations prepared after July 1st, 2008.
Correct.
With the understanding that it wouldn't go into effect until the budget of 2010.
That's not part of the amendment. But
right.
But that's what it is
with
doing.
The understanding of. Mr. Meyer?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the commission. It's my pleasure to talk to you about the exciting, stimulating topic of actuarial tables regarding mortality, life and death. I will be brief. Our purpose here is to get your approval through Resolution 08-1 to change the actuarial report. I'm going to be referring to the excellent memo prepared by Larry Martin, and I'm going to work from the back forward. Resolution 08-1 is the purpose for our request. The previous page is our written letter to make that request. As the actuary for Minneapolis Police, we have a professional responsibility to provide our opinion as to the appropriateness of the assumptions. We've done significant numbers of studies and determined that the current table is inadequate. We made a request last year, and no action was taken, so we issued the actuarial report with the current table, but did insert a caveat that said, in our professional opinion, the current mortality table no longer met actuarial standards. And we will do that with the December 31st, 07 report as well. But we did issue the report with the current standards. The table we are requesting is an offshoot of the 1983 GAM table, which if you go to the next prior two pages, shows you that virtually every other fund in the state uses that table in some form. I'd like to refer to attachment C1 and just make a brief comment that there are two kinds of assumptions. This is on C1. It's about the fifth paragraph. There are economic assumptions like interest, salary scale, inflation, and there are demographic assumptions relating to turnover, mortality, early retirement, and so forth. By state law, economic assumptions can only be changed through statute. But also by state law, demographic assumptions rely on the opinion of the actuary subject to the approval of the commission. So that's why we're before you tonight. We'll flip ahead to now page 8-3, which is just a comment. I'm going to make a factual correction here. In this memorandum, it mentions that the current contributions are $32 million annually. That was the proper amount for the 2005 actuarial report. In 2006, it was $11 million. And in 2007, which is yet to be issued, but we have a draft, it's $7 million, just a little bit under. Flip to page 4. One of the reasons for changing mortality is that it's old. And I'm here to tell you that just because something is old doesn't mean it can't do the job anymore. And the older I get, the more I believe that to be true. But we test...
Me too.
Yes. We test the table each year to see if it's doing the job, and it has showed consistent recurring actuarial losses. So we know that this old table no longer does the job. And I'll just conclude with the very first page, where we have the summary of the proposed change. We are recommending a change based on mortality review experience studies that we've done since 2003. We've updated them to 2007. We're recommending a change to a standard table, which is the 1983 GAM mortality, with some adjustments to make it fit the experience of this particular group. So we're going to adjust females as if they were 1 year older and males as if they were 2 years younger. And that table produces the proper fit, in our opinion. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
We don't have any.
Please.
Does someone from the city want to comment?
Madam Chair, while somebody's coming up, I guess I will ask a question because I got the briefing, but there was one age group that was not explained. It was around age 50 to 55 or something like that where the numbers didn't match for whatever reason. Have we been able to figure out why adjusting the tables didn't work out for that group?
Mr. Meyer?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel. That particular age group is a particularly small one right now. This is a closed group where the bulk of the people are older and retired. And so with the small group, you're going to see more variations. And that's one of the criticisms or problems we face in trying to select any table for a group of this size. How do you get it to fit exactly? And nothing fits exactly. This is not a perfect prediction, but it's better than the current table.
City of Minneapolis.
Madam Chair, I'm Pat Bourne. I'm the city's chief financial officer. Thank you for hearing us out. We do appreciate Representative Thiessen's amendment to the action in front of you tonight. My comments will be very brief. Like your staff report suggests, the City of Minneapolis does support periodic review and updating of key actuarial assumptions. This action addresses only one of the three key actuarial assumptions, mortality, and we do support this this change. We decided to support this change some time ago, effective 2010. You should be aware, however, that the changing this one assumption alone is costly. It's in the range of $10 million per year, starting in 2010 and running until 2020. You can see that this is a significant cost that city taxpayers will bear. We have been planning this for some time. I also want to point out that by not considering the investment assumption and the salary assumption while they're in statute, does in effect penalize city taxpayers. So like your staff, we would recommend that the commission also consider studies that update and review those other two assumptions, which we think is fair and, frankly, consistent with your pension management policies. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Thank you. Questions? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, when the agreements, the retirement agreements were signed or were entered into, was there a specific reference to this mortality table? Because I think there were specific references to those other components that you mentioned. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, you would assume that mortality tables are the kinds of things that would change over time, unless they were specifically referenced in the agreement. If it just said, you know, that you're going to get this benefit under these particular terms, then it seems to me it wouldn't make sense to change those terms unless you were changing something that was part of the agreement, and then it would make sense to review all of those things.
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator, are you referring to the agreement that was made several years ago when the amortization date was made to the change in the amortization date was made when we agreed to make this change?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, no, sir. I'm just referring to the agreement that you had with police officers in terms of their retirement. If there was nothing in that agreement that tied it to a particular mortality table, but just that, you know, then that's really not the same thing as those other two things you were talking about that were part of the agreement, I would think.
Mr. Braun.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, police officers don't make agreements about actuarial assumptions when they sign up for a retirement plan, to my knowledge. These actuarial assumptions are established by the legislature, two of them in state law and one of them by action of the commission. The retirees and the individual retirees, at least, don't, if I'm understanding, and maybe I'm not understanding your question correctly, but they're not necessarily agreeing to these. These assumptions are used to determine funding levels, and they're not really used to determine benefit levels. They're used to determine the adequacy of funding, and therefore are very important to the parties that are causing the funding to be in place.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
Madam Chair, sir, that I think though that was exactly my point, and my point was that. Those other two things that you talked about, the salary and what was the other one you said?
Investment.
And investment. I mean, those were part of the agreement that you made, I believe, or part of what was in your retirement package, whereas I don't think the mortality tables would have been represented as being tied to anything specific. They would be whatever would be the most accurate mortality table that I would assume that was available, and that's kind of an actuarial determination. So I guess that's why I don't quite understand the logic of the assumption that you would change things that were part of the retirement agreement simply because the reality of the actuarial table changed.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't know how better to explain this, but mortality assumptions, the investment rate of return assumptions that are used to determine funding, and the annual adjustment to the annual pension benefit are all, in effect, drivers of determining at what level does the city and the state make contributions to these plans to get them fully funded. They're all equally important in their own way in determining the adequacy of funding to the plan. To suggest that the city somehow created these plans and established these assumptions that would never change in the remainder of the life of the plan is in my opinion, not good pension policy. Pension plans should be periodically reviewed for their adequacy and accurateness of their and fairness of their actuarial assumptions. And if the underlying assumptions and the facts that drive them should change over time, then those assumptions should be reviewed and updated periodically. And that mortality assumption no different than any other of the actuarial assumptions.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Bourne is correct on this one. It's not tied to, just like the mortality assumption changes the how much you got to pay in. If we're not right about what our investment returns are going to be in projecting out into the future, or not right about what salaries are going to be projecting out in the future, we do need to adjust those to make sure that we're contributing enough money to make sure that the fund is whole. So I think it's different than an agreement about what benefits and what's going to drive benefits. So just let me just make two other comments, because I would make them anyway. First, I'd like to acknowledge the city and their willingness to work on this issue. And I hope that it's a symbol of things going forward here.
Me too.
And secondly, probably the point that Mr. Bourne is making to look at these things, I think that my sense, just from what I've seen, is that the investment and the salary numbers are not that far off currently. But it's always worth continuing to look at those numbers as we go forward.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think, just made my point, and that is just and with the assumptions, and I have said at this very table before about the importance of looking at the total package as we move forward. And so I would just encourage the city and the stakeholders to take that into consideration as they move forward. And thank both of them for their combined efforts on coming together in some fashion on this. So, thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Thiessen.
I would move resolution 08-1 as amended. That'd be, I guess, adopted by the commission? Or
and it incorporated?
We don't have to pass this.
Oh, that's right. Just adopt it. Which is an administrative action by the commission. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Resolution 08-1 as amended is adopted.
Thank you.
Number 12. Senator Bedfeld?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that actually the Pension Commission staff brought to me based upon a review that we do every year. A couple of years ago, we wound up having situations where we had many requests for people who wanted to get into the correctional retirement plan, because mainly it allowed for earlier retirement. But we try to set up some guidelines because some correctional officers obviously had a lot of contacts with inmates, and it was a dangerous job. And we recognize that there was certainly a time limit to work those kind of jobs. You could not work them until you're 60 or 65 years old. But then there were many other people who worked maybe in the correctional area or had jobs that did not have as much contact, and so there really wasn't as much reason. And trying to sort out who should be in the plan and who should not be, has been an ongoing thing. Now, we've set up a system over the recent years to try to identify just who those are. This is the latest review that we've received on MSRS correctional, and it would add two occupational positions, and I think I'll just defer to Mr. Martin to further discuss the recommendation that we have before us.
Yes, members. This is a process that once was done administratively and had a different approval process. Then it was there was no process in place for adding to the correctional plan. And then I believe in 2005, this process was set up where there was an internal process within both the Corrections Department and the Human Services Department related to the to the sex offender program and the security hospital in St. Peter that there would be evaluations of proposed inclusions to the plan. They would be forwarded to the legislature. The practice has been that the commission staff then takes those recommendations, drafts the bill, and provides it to the primary members of the commission for their introduction so it can be considered. In this case, only corrections is making a recommendation for an increase in the membership of the correctional plan, and there are two positions, one which has an incumbent and one which does not. The two positions are laid out in the middle of page two. The one that has an incumbent is the general maintenance worker lead. The position that does not have an incumbent is a painter lead position. Specifically in the bill, if you're interested where these are, they're on page 2, lines 9 and 14. It's the list of additional correctional employees who are included in the plan, and those are the two additions. The issues that we raise in connection with this, the first one is a comfort issue. If you're, as this process goes on and as it seems to work more for a longer and longer period of time, presumably commission comfort level with the process grows, and there can be less and less scrutiny of it and more deferral to the process. This is the third time that the process will have been utilized. Second item has to do with the extent of inmate contact. One of the principal drivers of whether someone gets in or does not get into the plan is meeting a 75% of inmate contact requirement. And this is perhaps the area where I would raise the most questions typically and do here. For the position where there is an incumbent, it's clear that one can look at the actual job experience of a person and make the determination. The determination that the Corrections Department has made is this is an 80% of time inmate contact position, although there is some bouncing around in the actual job description of whether it adds up cleanly to the right number, but it is somewhat over 75%, but reasonably close. For the painter lead position, I have always raised as a problem area anytime a position which has no incumbent is suggested to be added, since it's very difficult to evaluate how much contact time someone will have in the abstract. And I raised that again with this position, which does not have an incumbent. So it is something of an estimate of what happens. The last item that I raise on page 3 is the actuarial condition of the plan. And I've given you 3 years' worth of actuarial work summarized in the middle of that page. And if you roll all the way down to the bottom of the three columns, the one of the key items is, are the current contributions sufficient to meet the actuarial requirements of the plan? And the plan in 2005 had about a 4% of payroll deficiency that bounced up to just shy of 10% in 2006 and is right now around 8% of pay. So I do raise the issue that this plan does have some funding difficulties. And if you did want to address them, there are two amendments which would speak to increases in contribution rates, phasing them over different times. But that's if you're concerned about the broader issue of the condition of the plan. We do have representatives from the Department of Corrections, I believe, including the warden at Rush City here to help answer questions.
And, warden, do you want to comment? Or Ms. Cox? Or somebody?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Well, they're coming up.
Representative Nelson.
The question I have on my mind for the position that's the general maintenance worker lead that's currently filled, is there an opportunity? Is this going backwards or is this going forward? So I guess I'm asking, is there an opportunity here for
them to purchase service credits and going up sometime in the future? Or is this, I guess that's...
Or we could get a job.
Yeah. My understanding, members, is that this position was filled in December of 2007. There is some general authority to go back to cover past service, but we're talking about a matter of a small number of months. So it presumably is a relatively modest number of dollars.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
My name is Kent Granlinard. I'm the Associate Warden of Administration at the state's maximum security prison at Oak Park Heights. Oh. So I'll be answering any questions the chair of the committee may have regarding the lead maintenance worker position. As Mr. Martin pointed out, it was just filled. It's a relatively new position to us at Oak Park Heights, and we filled it in December, and now we're trying to get it under the corrections early retirement plan.
And it fits all the categories.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Or all the criteria, I mean. Okay. Any other questions? That's Bergstrom,
just,
right?
Madam Chair, on the other position that does not have an incumbent.
Senator Bedford.
Yeah, we're assuming that, you know, that this... It doesn't have an incumbent, but we're assuming that if somebody is hired for that position, that they are going to meet the criteria, and how do we determine that for the painter lead?
Madam Chair and members of the Commission, I'm Anita Alexander, the Associate Warden of Administration at the Lionel Lakes Correctional Facility. In the lead painter position, although not filled currently, when it is filled, that person's duties would immediately involve direct supervision of anywhere from 2 to 4 offenders, from 8 until 11:15 in the morning, and then from 1 until 4:15 in the afternoon. So just about 6.5 hours each day. That would be total supervision. They work right with the staff painter, doing repairs of all 35, 36 of our buildings constantly. And so it would be immediate that supervision would begin as soon as a person is hired.
Thank you.
Senator?
Yeah. And would MSRS also be?
Yes, I think Mr. Bergstrom better come down.
While he's coming down, Madam Chair, just painters and maintenance workers are correctional?
Well, they work for corrections.
So, I mean, yeah. So they're covered currently, and these people are going to essentially be working with those same people. Am I getting this right?
Madam Chair and Representative Teasley.
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, I mean, they'd be MSRS employees, but of course, by being in the correctional plan, they get to retire earlier, and they're saying that if you're going to have this much contact with the inmates, they can't stay in, you know, beyond a certain age. They probably, and that's why we've allowed them to retire earlier.
I got it.
If I could help you, members, 1973, this plan was first set up for our correctional officers in the Department of our Corrections only, and for the security guards at the state security hospital. It was expanded in 1974 to include some tradesmen and special teachers, and it's been subsequently, it has been expanded periodically thereafter. The largest statutory change would have been in 96. When a number of nurses and other employees were added. The list that you see in the bill is mostly the increases from that 1996 expansion of the program, which covers a variety of individuals, although if you look on page 1, line 4, the chaplain position was added last year. So this is an ever-growing number, and it's based on the notion first established back in 74 when a number of our correctional industry employees, maintenance employees, and special teachers were being assaulted or otherwise put in physical harm, that they had roughly equivalent to correctional officer sorts of hazards and risks and should be in a plan that was more appropriate for those risks. And so the measure here that our determination here is how close to a correctional guard type risk or exposure are various employment oppositions in the various prisons.
And I would like to, as the author of the original bill, I would like to add that he mentioned last year we added the chaplain, and this year there's just two. And that's really a good thing, because we used to have 48, 24, 30, or whatever, and so we're getting there. And it's a new system. It's the criteria and the review at DOC that's doing it.
I remember all that now.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I, too, am excited that there are only two people. I have to commend the department. They did a great job. I especially like the fact that they were proactive, bringing in the one position before it even was filled, and now only having to worry about collecting back to December. There's no cost impact on MSRS.
And that's a good thing, too.
Madam Chair, that's a great thing.
What about what Mr. Martin said about whether, just advising us, whether we should be concerned about the growing deficit?
Madam Chair, that might be best left for the bill on our actuarial assumptions. That will address that somewhat, and I have some figures to do. So it's good to be concerned, but I think if we could look at it with that bill, it would probably be a better time to discuss it.
Okay. That's fine.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, you don't think that we need to really act on either of the amendments right now, because we're going to be dealing with that issue later on? Is that what you're suggesting?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that's correct.
I see. Okay.
Madam
Chair.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To my earlier question, I guess I'll point to Mr. Bergstrom. Has this individual that's in the general maintenance worker lead, is he aware of the service credit? And I guess going to what the two situations we had earlier tonight, I guess it's more of a statement. Wouldn't it be advisable to have him deal with his past credits earlier than later, so that we're not looking at a huge number later in 20 years from now?
And Madam Chair, that's exactly what's happening. We only have to go back to December. So the fact that they're catching this early, we're talking tens of dollars or $100 instead of tens of thousands of dollars.
Okay. Mr. Martin.
If I could help, if the attachment D has some information on from that MSRS gave us last year of what some of these back payment contribution requirements are. So if you can find D, it's a two-page. And on the bottom of the first page on D, on the top of second page of D, is a table with a large number of numbers on it. It lays out for short service, medium, longer service, and then very long service for various ages, some actual calculated contribution requirements. You can get some flavor from this. The younger and shorter, the younger the person is and the shorter the service, typically the less costly. And as as time grows and the ages increase, the dollar commitments are much greater. These are somewhat real live numbers.
Any further discussion? If not, Senator Betzel?
I'll move. Let's see. 20, Senate File 2720 be included in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Members.
He was talking about, right? Yeah. And then we'll be done. Okay. Senator Betzel, 2715.
Well, and Madam Chair, I believe this is from pension staff, is it?
No.
Or from the plan.
This is the actuarial from the funds.
The funds, I'm sorry, yeah. And actually, that.
Come on down.
This was introduced at their request, so I think we'll just hand it over to them and let them
Ms. Hacking?
Thank you. I have a couple of handouts. Madam Chair, my name is Laurie Hacking, Director with Teachers Retirement Association. This is a bill that we would like you to consider that finishes the work that the Commission started in December. You may recall you spent a large part of a hearing in December hearing from the actuaries, Siegel Actuaries, about the need to update our assumptions, our actuarial assumptions. And at that meeting, you adopted their recommendations relating to mortality, disability, turnover, and retirement assumptions, and you did it by virtue of a resolution. The bill before you today, in large part, addresses the remaining actuarial assumption changes that need to be made, and those are specified in statute. Those are the assumptions affecting payroll growth and salary growth. That is the large part of the bill. The experience studies found that the salaries and payrolls have not been growing as rapidly as assumed. And I've attached to the item that I just handed out the excerpt from the Siegel testimony to you back in December so that you can see what their recommendations were. So in general, the bill lowers the payroll growth assumption levels as well as the salary growth levels. We're also suggesting in this legislation perhaps a change in the process that is used to make actuarial assumption changes. And we're suggesting that we remove from law, from statute, the salary and payroll growth assumptions and set up a different process for proposing and implementing those changes. Under the process that we're suggesting, we would make it clear in statute that the retirement systems would be held responsible for proposing assumption changes, bringing those recommendations to the Pension Commission, accompanied by the concurring documentation from the actuary, and forward them to you for review and approval. And that review approval would expected to be occur in within 6 months of that recommendation. If no action would be taken, we would consider that concurrence on part of the commission. The intent of the process, this new process, is, as I said, to clarify responsibilities, assure that these changes are made in a timely manner. And also, you may recall that it's very difficult during the legislative session when you have very heavy agendas to take a good hour or so out to hear from the actuaries about these assumption changes and the reasons behind them. This, again, removing them from statute would allow you to deal with this in the interim rather than in the crush of a legislative session. The bill also proposes changes in the amortization periods for the three smaller plans. In fact, you were just discussing one of them a minute ago. Those three plans are para, police, and fire, MSRS correctional, MSRS judges plan. Those plans, because they are small, have short amortization periods, have been experiencing very wild fluctuations in their contribution rates. And if I could just finish before there are any questions, the two more minor changes that we're recommending in the financial reporting requirements that remove obsolete language that refers back to very old GASB Statement 5 language, which has been replaced by the more recent GASB 25 requirements that we are required to adhere by. And lastly, I'll just mention there are a couple of amendments that we would request your consideration, and that is Section 1 of the bill to delete that. It's language that refers to the post-fund calculation and really shouldn't be in the bill. We're not quite sure how it got in here. So we would request Section 1 be deleted. You were going to hopefully later hear a bill about the post-fund changes, and And you'll hear about those changes in that legislation. And also, I would we were asking to reinstate stricken language on page 11, lines 11, 23, 36. That's related to the same post fund issue. And the Pension Commission staff's amendment 14A, we would also like to urge you to take that action. It simply corrects an inadvertent omission of the change in payroll growth assumptions for the state patrol, legislator, judges, parapolice and fire, and local government correctional plans.
Okay, what was that first one that you wanted, section 1?
Delete section 1 of the bill relating to the post fund adjustment calculation. And related to that, on page 11, lines 11, 23.
Chair, I think this is going to be easier just to do them one at a time. I'm having trouble tracking this stuff. So I'll move to delete section 1.
On 3041.
3041. House file 3041, yeah.
Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Section 1 is deleted of 3041. Okay.
And then, Madam Chair, I think was it page 11 was the next one?
Yes.
What was it?
1123 through 1136, just to reinstate the stricken language.
Madam Chair, I'll move on page 11, lines. Oh, wait a minute. Let's see. Okay, so there's still parts of section 9 that you want to retain then. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I'll move to reinstate the stricken language on page 1123 through 1136.
So that's just the 8.5, right? The six.
Just retain the current.
Okay. Senator Betzel moves on page 11, lines 23 to 36, to reinstate the stricken language. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Ms. Hacking?
The last request we had is the amendment 14A in the staff's memo. We inadvertently omitted the payroll growth assumption changes that are needed for state patrol, legislators, judges, parapolice and fire, and local government correctional plans, and 14A amendment captures that.
I'll move the 14A amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of Amendment 14A. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, there's quite, as you can see, quite a bit to the bill, and there's a number of amendments. I just wonder if either PERA could comment. I mean, there's only one amendment that apparently you thought we should do, and a lot of options here. I'm not quite sure what to do.
I'm like, could you introduce these nice things?
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, the bill as the funds had worked on initially does represent the recommendations of the actuary as presented to you in December, and therefore we didn't feel any of the amendments were needed.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I agree with what Ms. Vanek said. The bill in its present form with the amendments you just adopted is what our intention was.
Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair, to our staff, are there any particular amendments that they want us to, you know, really take a look at and have any discussion on? I mean, they've got a whole list here, and obviously they're all prepared for some reason. So,
well, members,
Mr. Martin.
There are several items in the bill that were not part of what the recommendations of the actuary that were presented to you in December. So, to some extent, they're overstating the case. For instance, how financial reports are distributed to members is changed by this bill, but that was not part of what the actuary was presenting to us in December. But the principal thing I would raise has to do with shifting around who sets the salary rate assumptions and placing time limits on the commission's consideration of those changes. The -15A amendment, -16A amendment relate to whether the pension funds would be, in effect, setting the salary and payroll scale assumptions and just coming for commission approval. And then if commission approval doesn't occur within a certain period of time, they would become effective without our commission work, our commission approval. That is a change in the relationship between the pension funds, the pension commission, and the way we set actuarial assumptions. I do want to highlight that. Whether you want to do that or not is your choice, but that is something that's significantly different than what has been in place since 1965, and do want to, as the guardians to some extent of the institutional memory of the institution, to raise that, how you want to look at that whole issue. That would be the major thing I would suggest that you look at, because it does relate to the commission as an institution.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Bitzel.
Then what about that 15A, eliminating the delegation of authority instead of setting salary increase assumptions and expanding retirement plan discretion?
Madam.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Chair, Senator Bitzel, we would like to see our boards have the authority to change and give you a chance to overturn them. We get reports from our actuary. They look at every 4 years what they expected to see in their assumptions versus what really happened. Our trustees spend a lot of time looking at it. Oftentimes your schedule is busy. It takes a while to get the changes implemented, which then throws off the material in the actuarial report because the assumptions are not what reality is facing. We just think it's a good practice. It is not intended to take away any of your power, but quite frankly, it just lets us be a little more nimble and make the changes more quickly. And it is what most states do. Most states do have the ability to change the assumptions, mortality assumptions. I want to make it clear, we cannot change the investment assumption in this. We're not asking for that, but it's more the mortality and some of these other assumptions that drive the cost factors. And it just allows us to be more in tune to what the actuary is saying.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has the commission ever not approved actual assumption changes that you're talking about here?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, I am not sure if they have not approved them, but I know there have been significant delays. And those significant delays at times have actually required additional contribution rate increases because of that.
I think Ms. Vanek is an example where they tried to make some changes that were put off, and because of that delay, there was a delay in us recognizing it in our actuarial report. So where they have been made over time, I think from the time they get put in front of you until the time they're actually completed has taken some time.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think in reflecting on the operation of approving assumptions, there have been delays on both sides where the funds are trying to get enough data to support and understand why the actuary may be taking us in certain directions. There have been times when the commission has either been too busy or because of the inability to have the actuary come in and fully explain what may be a significant change. Things didn't happen, and in PARA's contribution situation in the early part of this decade was a result of disagreements, delays on actuarial assumption changes that could have been remedied earlier. And I'm not saying the legislature was at fault, the fund was totally at fault. It just isn't working as smoothly as you would like. The actuary makes a recommendation after every 4 years if it's necessary, because your plan experience is demonstrating we're forecasting based on the wrong assumptions.
And Madam Chair, my only point for raising the question was, if we always end up approving what they recommend, then I have less concern with turning over this authority. In fact, I'm happy to. But so that was all I was getting at. So if it is the course that we just adopt what they're recommending at some point, I don't see why we wouldn't let them act sooner.
Mr. Martin, have we always approved?
The commission has approved the recommended actuarial assumption changes, to the best of my recollection, but in some cases that only goes back for a relatively short period of time. The salary assumption and the interest rate assumptions have been in statute since 1965. The responsibility of the commission, or the authority of the commission, to specifically approve actuarial assumption changes only first occurred in 1987. It was added to the law in 1987. There were disagreements when the pension commission employed the actuary, and the actuary made recommendations. The pension funds objected to some of the actuarial assumption changes that our actuary was recommending, and there were disputes. Okay. And it took a while. Some of those were either delayed or hoped to be delayed. But in the main, we have had intensive looks at actuarial assumptions. The current actuarial work, the experience studies in the current case, did not actually lay out the data as Mr. Bergstrom tried to describe it, that there were a set of what was expected experience and what actually happened. The last set of experience studies were very deficient in the area of salary scale assumptions, presented virtually no data, recommended that there be a further study with the State Board of Investment, which no study as far as a document was ever produced. There was ultimately a conference phone call between several of the actuarial firms, the State Board of Investment, and the various pension funds, which resulted in a recommendation at the end of the day, which eventually was forwarded to the commission towards the end of the bill hearing period last session. But this was not a model year the last time we've had a set of experience studies or a model way of getting the recommendations before the pension commission. The actuaries punted on the salary scale assumption issue, and it didn't get resolved until well into the 2007 session, which is in part why it's here now.
Okay, that's helpful.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
I'm wondering if the change contemplates that a report would be made to the Pensions Commission of any actuarial assumption changes that were adopted, so that we would at least have them brought to our attention and a way to make sure that we so that it wouldn't delay the implementation, but that if there were some concerns or some things, that there would be a mechanism that it would be part of a report, and that if someone objected or had a concern, they could raise it.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, what we would do is report to you the changes. We would include documentation, and you would have 6 months to review them then and reject them if you so choose.
Mr. Martin.
Page 20 of the bill, I think, is what is the language that you're looking at or would want to look at. That's the current language on the establishment of actuarial assumptions. This would be the second page from the very back of the end of the entire document. It's the second to the last page of the bill, which is the last item in your packet. And Section 11 governs, it contains the current law on the establishment of the various demographic assumptions, and they would be adding to that the salary scale and payroll growth assumptions, and would be specifying a process with a deadline for the commission to act.
Madam Chair. Ms. Hacken.
I was just going to say, while you're looking at it, page 17 is also relevant. It specifies that the documentation that you were, Senator Olson was asking about. Page 17 and in the middle lines, 17, 15 through 21 also speaks to that same process.
Ms. Vanek, you said that they give you a report every 4 years. When does that come?
Madam Chair, Mr. Martin gets a copy of all experience studies, and I think the last one was through 2004, fiscal year 2004. So the next one, next.
2006. It's apparently following the 2006 valuations.
But I believe it's covering the period.
I'm pretty sure
it was 2003 through 2006.
Well, anyway, every 4 years, and we'll have another one coming up soon, within a couple of years.
But does it come in June, or does it come in December or February? Or
Madam Chair, usually May, I believe, is when it's usually supposed to be delivered. Siegel didn't meet that deadline, but I believe it's typically May, Mr. Martin.
Members, when the Pension Commission held the actuarial contract, it was the way we had it scheduled, the way it worked out, was done in the springtime because the actuarial evaluation work is done in the late summer and fall. And so whenever that was done, it was the following spring in whatever year, at fourth year that it was due, it would be done in the spring.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
That kind of gets at the question I was going to ask as well, whether the 6 months after the report is given to us, if it comes in May, 6 months would be November. We're not in session. I guess that's my question is 6 months the right time period for that, or do we want to make that longer so that we have time to look at it while we're in session? I guess that's the question I'm asking. And of you and Mr. Martin, and
that would be fine.
Exactly. And then even if we are in session, if we're not appointed, does it come that year, the odd year or the even year? I suppose that varies, huh?
Well, it's done every 4 years, and it was done in 2006, so it should.
The last experience study we did was for the period 2000 through 2004. We don't actually get the data and get it all analyzed until a good year and a half after that, the close of the fiscal years. But so the next one is going to be covering 05, 06, 07, and 08. So you won't actually be needing to worry about this until 2010.
It would be like this. It would be the second year. So that would be okay then.
It would be the spring of 2010.
Yeah.
So we'd actually
that's right.
In the odd year.
And so
we may not be appointed.
And we might not be appointed till April. which is what happened last year.
Madam Chair, that's what I'm thinking. I think I'd feel more comfortable if that was more like a year than instead of 6 months, because that way it's not becoming law or being changed without us having a chance to review it. Not trying to delay it, and I understand that you know, would make it 6 months longer, but I'd feel more comfortable if we were going to make this change having it set up so we'd have the ability to look at it.
And they wouldn't mind because they were going...
That's fine.
The plans wouldn't mind because they were in existence. I mean, they were doing what they wanted without our approval. But as it is, then that makes the point that sometimes we don't get around to it in a timely way because of not being appointed and busy.
So, yeah. Madam Chair, I guess I would like to amend this verbal or oral amendment, make that 6 months a year on page 20, line 19, and if Mr. Martin can help me, if there's any other place on page 17, I don't see a time.
It's actually two spots on page 20, 25, and 19.
Okay, and two, yeah, so I was wondering if there was more one spot that we'd have to make that change. There'd be two spots.
My understanding is page 20 would be the only change you would have to make to have a one-year time period. I can't think of anywhere else in the bill.
So I'd like to make that motion. Change line 25 and line 19 from 6 months to a year.
Chair, can I just ask
Representative Thiessen.
So is that, if you get it in May and we go a year to the next May, does that delay the assumption changes for a whole another year then?
Members, the valuation is done as of July 1. It's done in the fall of the year. So if we acted in the springtime, that's well in advance of the next valuation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it should work.
So Representative Nelson moves to on line 20 of the bill, page 20 of the bill, line 19 and line 25. Change 6 months to 1 year. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Now, does that go back to an amendment?
Okay. It eliminates the need for another amendment. I think.
Is there any further discussion?
And, Madam Chair, one more question. Again, has staff got any other things that you really want to flag to our attention that...
Mr. Martin.
The bill has a number of amortization date changes. They're basically extensions of amortization dates. Typically, the commission has done that accompanying major benefit improvements or some major event. This seems to be triggered more by a desire to have the actuarial work reflect an actuarial cost that seems to be lower. If that's your intent also, if that squares with what you would like to do. You have the power, most mortgagees don't have the opportunity to extend unilaterally their mortgage and reduce their monthly payments on their house. But that's in effect what you're in that position. You can change the mortgage period. And if you're comfortable with making the changes, which in some cases are relatively long given the duration, the remaining active lifetimes of the members of some of these plans, I just want to alert you that you are doing that.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, we're asking to change the amortization date on the Police and Fire Fund because you've been on the commission long enough. You saw that Police and Fire Fund over 100% funded for several years, and now it is under. It's roughly 92% funded. With that unfunded liability now and the target date of 2020, our contribution, even though we've increased contributions recently, the contributions are still deficient. And so we imposed a significant contribution rate increase on members and local units of government. And absent remortgaging the unfunded liability, we'll have to ask for, again, a significant contribution rate increase well above what we are already getting or imposing upon them. Police and fire personnel will be around a long time and in this plan a long time, so we think that it's reasonable to provide this the extended amortization period to provide that relief in the contribution rate. I don't have any other way to figure out how we're going to go to them and say, you know, we're 5 to 8% deficient, depending upon what numbers we're looking at. I think it's around 5% with these assumption changes, but current valuation shows like we're like 7.8% deficient, even though our contributions are going to a rate higher than they've ever been. And so that's our only real remedy for that plan.
Well, Madam Chair, and I, it seems to me that when we've been requested to push back the amortization date, I think we've usually done it, but usually there was some reason that we had to do it. You know, we've been, the post funds have been criticized because, you know, they're sometimes underfunded. Now, the mortgage isn't due today, so it's okay that they're underfunded as long as we were on track for full funding, and that's been just one of the tools that we've had. Just keep pushing the date out, make some adjustments. I'm just wondering, though, if we're not paying attention to the fact that the date is being pushed back, are we setting a trap for ourselves where all of a sudden we find out that, you know, the problem's been more serious than we thought it was, and we just didn't catch it because we weren't in the loop when the amortization date was revised, and, you know, we didn't know that it was, because, you know, as I say, normally we know about it because we're doing a couple other things, including that.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, all I would say to that is we've incrementally been doing things to the Police and Fire Fund, increasing contributions, modifying the benefit plan to try to address some of the reasons why the unfunded has come about. And this is our last option. We did something similar for the general plan in 2001 because it was really at the time one of the only possibilities to provide a little bit of contribution relief for those participating in the plan. And I know it in the long run it costs more money, but when we look at it in a shrinking period of time, we're losing a year every year to pay off an unfunded liability now, and that was before the post fund was recognized as part of it. So if anybody's got any other option to consider as some kind of relief without imposing significantly higher contributions, I'm open.
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And typically we are okay to go out 30 years, right? I mean, that many of our funds are amortized over that length of time, and right now we're looking at 12 years for this fund. Is that what we're saying? Is 2020?
Madam Chair.
So
several of the plans, Representative, are 2020. Yes, there is an automatic procedure in current statute that extends that 2020 date if there are benefit improvements or assumption changes, and sets a new 30-year period for that new increment of unfunded, and then blends the two. The old unfunded with the old period and the new little chunk of unfunded or bigger chunk of unfunded with its own 30-year period blends them together in a weighted average basis and creates a new date. In some cases, the language here actually takes some of these plans out of that automatic practice. So in the future, they're going to have a single date, which will not extend automatically when they do change future benefit benefits or change future actuarial assumptions, just because it's not particularly well drafted. The 30-year is the only magic to that is that that's the standard in federal law for a lot of pension plans, that you cannot exceed 30 years when you're on an ongoing basis. They did allow 40 for multi-employer plans when they were first starting. And also GASB frowns will provide an adverse comment in the audit work if you have an actuarial period, if you do the calculation for a period longer than 30 years. There are a number of pension plans that don't have any actual amortization requirement at all. They don't have contributions sufficient to amortize. They're unfunded. Thinking of Oklahoma and West Virginia as a couple, where it's infinite is their amortization period in practice, but they calculate a 30-year amortization period to disclose what it would be if they were following that.
And Madam Chair, we also don't we have some place where we do a rolling 30-year?
Representative Thiessen, in current law, the only time we do a rolling 30 is if you're overfunded.
Oh,
and we're
see.
Taking okay. that as a credit.
Okay.
It's a rolling 30 on that. You take some portion of it as a credit. There was a proposal last year in combination or in connection with the St. Paul teacher plan.
Well, that's where that's coming. Okay.
A rolling 30 for right. an existing unfunded, but the only one in current statute has to do with you have a funding surplus, you're doing a reverse amortization.
All right. That's why it sounds familiar.
Mr. Bergstrom, were you?
Madam Chair, as Ms. Vanek said, we don't take extending amortization periods lightly, but MSRS is proposing an amortization change for our correctional plan and our judges plan. And I handed out a one-page sheet that shows you've got a front and back, so it's the one with the two different valuations. And we have just recently gone to the correctional plan and asked for contribution rate increases from the employee of 2.91% and employer contributions of 4.12% that are being phased in. You can see if we just look at the second to the bottom line, we started with an actuarial report of a negative 3.7% contribution rate. The assumption changes included in this bill brings it to 3.1%. If we extend the amortization period from 16 years to 30, it brings the required contribution to a negative 0.9 tenths. At this point, because of the phasing in, I would not recommend any contribution rate changes. So we just don't think that the departments nor the employees can handle another increase at this time. With the judge's plan, we actually have a 13-year amortization period. And you can see that after the assumption changes that were made, one of that being mortality adjustments that you approved at your last meeting, it shows that we go from a 6.3% deficiency to 0.7% sufficiency. In plans this small and you shrink that amortization period, you get wild swings of what your required contribution rates would be. For example, let's say you were 1 year away from 2020 and the markets dropped $500 million. Next year, your payoff would be $500 million. So shrinking amortization periods themselves cause some grief for a pension plan that is in existence for an ongoing basis. So, in light of the recent contribution rate increases that have been implemented, we think this is a reasonable way to ease that financing.
Members, if I can throw in one or two comments. What we do in Minnesota and have since 1984 is we amortize our unfunded accrued liabilities not on a level dollar basis, which is how most people pay their house mortgage, but we do it on a level percentage of an increasing payroll, which inherently is a balloon payment scheme or method. It assumes an ever-increasing, by the payroll assumption, contribution. And what happens is, for essentially the first half of whatever period it is, you're not even paying the full interest on the unfunded, much less paying any of the principal. And a lot of that gets ballooned to the later years. So in part, when these periods start to shrink, when we move into that second half of whatever the period originally was, that you start having problems. That's what we're seeing, is because we had the gravy of having a reduced amortization contribution in the early years of the period, we now get the adverse impact of having the balloon being swallowed. We don't provide any automatic extension of an amortization period or any way to amortize the various experience losses that do occur. So as Mr. Bergstrom was saying, if you had a large market downturn, we do have the actual value of assets, which does potentially smooth to some degree, but we don't amortize on a separate period, which it would be allowed for private sector plans, for instance. The federal law does allow to set an extra amortization period for experience losses. We don't do that. I at the moment can't identify which amendment there is, but I do have a way to do that with experience gains or experience losses. That's part of the set of amendments in the packet, which would help alleviate some of those fairly end of the period large investment loss scenario, something like that.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Benzel.
I recognize we're pressed for time. I'm assuming we're going to have at least, hopefully, one more meeting before we wrap it up.
Oh, I bet we're going to have more than one.
But rather than act on this one tonight, we've had some discussion on it, but I'd like to just hold this out here for a little while longer just to see if there's anything else we ought to be thinking about before, because this is rather comprehensive, and I'd rather not make the motion right now to rule it in. So,
members, we will generate an unofficial engrossment of other various amendments that you've already done, so you have a more up-to-date document for the next time you do look at it, if that's your preference.
That would be helpful. Representative Nelson.
If he could also, I guess the question, if he could also, you mentioned there's some drafting or poor drafting, that if you've got amendments in here, point them out that might fix some of those problems. And so I don't like landmines, and I guess if we can get away from some landmines in the future, it would be great.
Any other discussion? Then Senator Betzel moves that we hold this over for a second consideration. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I can give a very brief discussion on number 14 on the agenda. I'm not going to be moving any action on this, but I'd like to indicate the discussion point here. As the memo indicates, this commission used to have its retain its own actuary up through 2004, and we got rid of our own actuary for a couple of reasons. First of all, budget considerations. We went through, obviously, a very difficult time period in 2003 and 2004. The legislative branch took its share of the budget cuts, and among them, we cut the funding to retain our own actuary. Also, at that very same time period, the individual from Milliman, as I recall, was retiring. And they also wanted us to sign an agreement, a hold harmless agreement, that basically said that if they were wrong, we couldn't hold them liable for that. And some of us thought that didn't make a lot of sense. If they screwed up, they ought to be liable. Yep. So, but for many reasons, we restructured it so that we were relying upon the funds. And at some point, we may want to revisit that. When you look at the full state budget of about $34 billion compared to what pensions cost, I mean, there's, what, $50 billion or more in pensions? You know, this is significant. And I think that at some point we need to have our own set of eyes that work for the pension commission. Now, whether it's a
you know, we hire our own actuary or we go back to having a consulting actuary. I mean, there's a lot of ways we can discuss it. Certainly, this is not the time we can do that. I mean, we had a budget crisis in 03 and 04, and we have another budget crisis right now. And once again, the legislative branch is probably going to take its share of the cuts. So this is not a time when we can be, you know, really seriously considering it. But it's something I've thought of the last few years, and I recently, before I got this bill introduced, I actually discussed with Senator Pogemiller, who was the past chair of this commission, and he felt pretty strongly, too, that this is something we ought to take another look at to see if we really did the right thing. But as I say, I'm not going to really want to spend any time on it tonight because there's really nothing we can do in the short run on it. But I want to get the discussion going as to what's the best way that we as a commission can get the information we need. And also, you know, the funds, obviously, they need the information that they have in order to do it if we're going to have, you know, sound pension policy. So that's the purpose of the bill. And I think that's all that I know the funds have their thoughts on it, too, but we really don't need to engage in a discussion right now. But I just wanted to explain the rationale for the bill.
Any discussion? If not, we'll hold it over for some time, maybe. But I bet we should talk about it this summer.
Yep.
Okay. Number 15, is anybody here for that? Mr. Kapler?
Madam Chair and members, I think Mr. Stoffel wants to comment on this item as well, and I think we know where the rest of the funds stand on the provisions in Senate File 2006 and House File 2194. This is a bill that was introduced last session. There is a cleanup amendment to that bill that does need some minor cleanup to itself. Staff took a draft amendment that went back into this bill because the original bill had provisions in there about the amortization target date for St. Paul teachers, and I think it eliminated the post-retirement excess earnings offset provision in there, and it was going directions that weren't really sort of tightly limited to the actuarial services contract. And that's what this bill is about. It's something that really goes quite the opposite direction of the bill that Senator Betzold has in, and that's what you meet for, is to discuss these things. But this is really just about actuarial services and who writes the contract, who the actuary reports to initially first, and you know, how that relationship is structured between the funds, the technical experts, and the policymakers, and that's what this is about. If you look at the amendment that staff has passed out, Madam Chair, the only changes, and these are real minor tweaks, would be on line 1.12. The last two words, the effect of that strike line 22 is to delete the last two words on page 3, line 22, and I think you want to keep them concerning the. Otherwise, the sentence doesn't quite succeed. And then line 1.17 on the amendment, 16A, page 5, line 20, strike everything before. It says who there. I think it should say is. Otherwise, you end up with the word who occurring twice in a row when you splice a sentence together with the next line. And those are very minor technical things. The effect of those changes, Madam Chair, is to remove the pieces that deal with amortization target dates for St. Paul. That's a separate and distinct policy issue. This is administrative, technical, and the funds position basically is the current paradigm situation. We jointly contract with an actuary The limit on the amount of number of years that contract can be extended is coming up. I think I conveyed to you that it was up this year in last time we spoke, and that's not the case. We actually would have one more year that we could extend past June 30 of this year. That would take the Siegel contract out to five, doing the evaluations for all the major plans. The problem is if it's not the intention of the funds to re-up that, the contract would have to be relet, an RFP would have to be done next year, and then we're sort of racing against time to have an actuary on board next cycle around. So this is something that we think is better dealt with this year. From the fund's perspective, we're all going to have to hire an actuary. We're all going to have to retain one to do evaluation. For a number of years, St. Paul did not have the actuary that reported directly to the board and was not the sort of official actuary for the funds. Do a full valuation. We've just found that doesn't work if we're going to be doing serious analysis of policy proposals, either prospective or those that arise during the legislative session. So I think all the funds are always going to have an actuary on retainer, and we're, I think, almost always going to have them do a full valuation because they can't do any analytical work unless they have that base level data. So what we've really got is a duplication of services here, and we think that the paradigm that makes the most sense is if the funds hire the actuary, if the pension commission specifies how it wants the valuation structured, what specific components of information you need, the methodology and standards by which those valuations are going to be done, and then we build that. That's in our contracts with the actuaries, and we just force them to deliver what you need. It just eliminates duplication. It's expensive what we're doing now. It's twice as much work every year coordinating with two actuaries. I think pension commission staff would say that we really only need one if we've got one actuary jointly hired by the funds or that actuary is hired by the pension commission. We should all be able to work through the one. And what we found is that there are just so many elephants that can get through the door in September, October, and November, and we run into significant delays trying to get these things done. And the actuary, frankly, is put in a very awkward spot, having to decide which valuations are going to run first. And last year, it was some of the bigger plans that ended up coming out later. This year, we didn't get our valuation until December. And it's kind of a domino thing. If our evaluation doesn't get done until the middle of December, the auditors can't complete their report. And until the auditors complete their audit report, we can't issue an annual report for the fund. So in the middle of January, we're now racing to the printer to try and get our annual report to the members and everybody else who does business with St. Paul Teachers and to you. And that's for the year ended June 30 of 2007. The years are starting to blur together, and we just don't think it's an efficient process.
Mr. Stoffel?
Madam Chair, my name is Jay Stoffel, Director of Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. I'll try not to be too duplicative of what Mr. Kapler just said, but I think the main question we're really asking in Senate File 2006 and also in Senate File 2923 is whose actuary is doing the actuarial valuation work and experience study work. And for us, it's a very important question. The role of the actuary plays a very important role for the pension fund boards, and we take that responsibility very seriously. It's like hiring, for us, it's like hiring a lawyer, a CPA, an investment manager, all the other professionals that advise us on the business of running the pension funds. Currently, the model is that the six major pension funds hire one actuary on a joint basis. What Senate File 2006 really does is it allows us each to independently hire our own actuarial firm to do the official valuations and the experience studies for each of the pension funds. It also allows for an overseeing actuary to be hired by the Pension Commission to review those actuarial valuations and experience studies and anything else that they want to have done at your request, of course. The consulting actuary would be your actuary. Our actuary would be doing the official valuation work. And that's the fundamental question here, is who's doing the valuations? And again, we think that's a very serious question, a very important role for us to play. We find that to be our fiduciary responsibility to do that valuation work, do the experience studies. And so fundamentally, that's the way we answer that question. But as an administrator of the fund, I find it somewhat awkward to be dealing with five other parties to a contract with a professional actuarial firm. There are some that things that happen along the way where questions are asked and issues come up, and we deal with it, and it happens. It's not an impossible relationship, but it's very awkward to have six parties to one contract. What we're suggesting is we do that work independently. We each hire our own. And again, the Pension Commission staff would avail themselves of an actuarial firm as well. I have a one-page summary of what is contained in Senate File 2006 with the amendment, which would strip out any change of actual dates, amortization dates. There are some earnings limitations that are in the bill. We want to strip everything out of the bill other than this issue of the actuarial services contract. So it's a pure, clean bill related to actuarial services. So what you would be left with, if you look at the summary, is Roman numeral 1, the funds would hire their actuary. Each fund hires its own independent actuary to do three things: the valuations, experience studies, and actuarial cost estimates of legislative proposals. Having that authority, we would follow the current statutory requirements and the standards that are in place already. So all this work would be done according to current statutes and standards. We could devise a consistent format so that the comparability would not be lost. We want to work with the commission and the commission staff to make sure that you get what you need to have, and we certainly need to see the information that we want as well. But I think comparability is an issue, and we can develop a format. If we like the current format, we'll say that's the format we want to retain, and all the actuarial firms will report in that fashion using that format. The Pension Commission would receive copies of all the valuations and all the experience studies. Letter C, upon completion of an experience study, the pension fund actuary would report to the pension fund boards and the Pension Commission of the recommendations and the appropriateness of the actuarial valuation assumptions, and then each fund would pay for its own actuary. Roman numeral 2 lays out the setup of the actuarial firm that would be used by the Pension Commission. The Pension Commission would hire a qualified actuary. Letter B, the actuary retained by the Pension Commission will work with the pension fund boards to obtain our data on an annual basis. Your actuary would need our data, our demographic data, all of our member data on an annual basis, and we would work with you to accomplish that. Your actuary would advise you on the reasonableness of the reports that they're reviewing for you, the valuations, the experience study. Any other issue that you have that you want to consult with your actuary would be done by your actuary. They could also do cost proposals, letter D. We would be doing cost proposals, but if you wanted to run them past your own actuary, they could do that as well. And finally, you would have an appropriation to pay for that actuarial work that you would be having done at your request. And that's, I think, essentially what we're trying to bring to the discussion today is whose actuary is doing this actuarial work. And in a nutshell, we really think it's very important that that's an administrative function, a fiduciary role that we play as pension fund boards.
And Madam Chair, that last bullet will be appropriated funds to retain the services of consulting firm. That's the point I made earlier. It's probably an awkward discussion to have at this moment, so.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to say that since both of these bills are basically different approaches to the same issue, that maybe it would be appropriate to, have some work between with Senator Betzold's bill and the proposal, and maybe come back, and maybe staff could put some comparisons for us together to look at the different approaches when we have a little bit further down the road when we've had a chance to.
Mr. Kapler.
Madam Chair, and Senator Betzold, to your question, that there is an appropriation. I mean, if you've got a contract with somebody, you've got to spend money. And even if you did this in a revolving fund type account, I mean, you'd have to seed it then with capital somewhere. So what's in this proposal now, by virtue of the amendments, is an appropriation's made, but in effect, what happens is it works very much the way the state auditor operates. You make an appropriation to the state auditor for $6 million, $7 million, whatever it's at now. Those costs are billed back to the entities that they perform the audit work for, so the general fund recovers everything except for a constitutional office and a few other items there, some small residual of the state auditor's budget. Everything else is recovered back into the general fund. So it's really just the appropriation is really just a cash flow accommodation. We would pay back the costs of the actuarial work that the Pension Commission's actuary did, but you'd have to have an appropriation initially in order to have anything to bill back in expenditure. So that's the way it works now. It would be fiscally neutral if it were done that way.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Kapler, it's a loan, of course, but it's going to be very difficult. $6 million, you know, within a $34 billion budget, of course, is nothing, but when we're facing the billion-dollar shortfall we've got, there just isn't anything we can look at. I mean, it's, you know, but we're going to have a lot of discussions on a lot of issues over the next couple of weeks, but I think if I brought this issue to the Senate Finance Committee right now, they'd have some derision of my proposal right now. So,
yeah, I think you'd have to put a couple $100,000 in there, probably,
yep,
for starters.
Is that what you think the appropriation would be?
Well, our contract with Siegel is for less than that, and quite frankly, I think Siegel has found that they did not bid high enough. And they did not realize how much it was going to cost. I think the actuaries thought, and all those who bid on the contract thought, that there were going to be economies of scale here, because once it got done doing one valuation for one Minnesota plan, it was going to be very easy to move to the next one, and they were going to be able to do those in rather cookie-cutter fashion. And what they found out is that every one of these plans is just different enough. The funding is leveraged just differently enough that it really didn't work, and each valuation kind of became a whole and contained thing unto itself. And they didn't make a lot of money off of us, I'll tell you that. We know that.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question that's in my mind, and probably good for future discussion, but you're getting at a little bit my question is, with economies of scale, whether we're going to end up costing more money by having multiple actuarials with multiple fees that'll be costing to the individual funds, whether that's appropriate or not. I know in my other job that they're actually going the other direction, where they're trying to get to having less actuarials and less of those costs, and having one for all the funds that they overlook, to try and cut down on costs to the fund. So I guess that's in my mind. I guess whether it's going to cost more or less, it's a question I'd have if we went this direction.
Mr. Stoppel?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I think that's correct. I think that's an issue we have to be careful of and address that issue. When we break this up, we'll be bidding independently, and the economy of scale will be lost to some extent. I think the ones that could be impacted the most could be the smaller funds, St. Paul and Duluth Teachers. The state plans still have multi-billions and several plans and lots of work to do, so there could be some economies of scale that they retain, but we may end up paying a little bit more. But I think the efficiencies that we gain and the relationship that we gain by having our own independent actuary is an offset to the additional cost.
Well, hearing that, does anyone else have a comment? Mr. Kapler.
One last point, Madam Chair, and that is, these are two very different proposals. One takes us back to the way that we were operating before the funds jointly hired the actuary, and I think Senator Betzel reviewed the history on that well enough. Where we're at right now, we consider to be something of a dysfunctional arrangement, about to get dysfunctional with a very, very compressed timeline for resolution next year if we don't do something. And this is basically cutting out one actuary, cutting out duplication, and it's asking the Pension Commission to trust us to deliver what you need as policymakers and force our actuaries, our technical experts, to do that. I think what's really kind of if folks have questions, it's how does that relationship work between an auditing or overseeing actuary that reports directly to the commission, and we all think that you most emphatically need one, and our actuaries. And I think that's the piece that would have to be worked out, and it's got some uncertainties with it. And I think perhaps maybe you would drive more comfort, and you could consider this between now and the time we next take this up, if we just put a sunset on whatever arrangement we have. I mean, we know what it's like to have the actuary directly hired by the commission. We know what it's like to have it hired by the funds as a gang. We don't know what it's like yet to have an auditing actuary work for the pension commission overseeing our actuaries' work and working in collaboration with them more closely. We really don't see them in an adversarial fashion, and neither do our actuaries. They love the idea that somebody else is overlooking their work, and I tell them I like it too, just not every year because it costs me a ton of money. So we're okay with that. And maybe if you just put a sunset on whatever law change we did, made it session law and not a codified change, then we're all forced to come back in 4 years and say, is the pension commission happy with what they're getting? Does the staff consider it a dysfunctional relationship that needs fine-tuning or a complete overhaul? I just have a real strong bias to sunsetting any significant policy change just because it does force you to come back and revisit things that you were uncertain about going in. Two bits.
Okay, I think we will hold this over for second consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And I have a couple ideas of discussion groups that I'll share later. I was thinking more of beer.
My puritanic upbringing.
I see that the agenda has come to the end. Representative Nelson?
I move adjournment.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you for your cooperation. Thank you for your expediency tonight. We did a really good job. We're an hour shorter than I thought we would be. This meeting is adjourned.
How does that work?
Discuss amortization.